everybody. We're going at it tonight. There's a party on the rooftop, top of the world. Matt Bubala here with you on 720 WGN. Thanks for staying up even later with us. I'm going to try standing for a little bit. We've got these new, as you've heard us talk about ad nauseum, Roger, we've got these new studios here at 303.
Yeah, pretty stuff.
And I think every setup is set up so you could stand and talk instead of sitting. But you've got tall chairs. You can still sit.
Yeah. But I alternate during the evening.
That's a good idea. It's good for us, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I need to get up. I mean, people think I do like tons of stuff every day.
No, you do nothing.
Well, for like 90% of the day, I'm sitting on my behind trying to find something on Prime to watch or taking a nap. But it's that 10% of the day where I cram in about 100 things.
Yeah.
So it's this is nice to be able to stand up a little
bit. Especially when you're here in the overnight hours.
Well, yeah.
You need to get the blood moving at times.
Yeah, yeah, you know? Definitely. I mean, and it kind of keeps me active when I'm standing. I can't stand too long. I still have a little neuropathy in my feet. So I have to kind of, you know, sit up for a while. But standing kind of gives you a different vibe, you know?
Yeah, I don't know if I love it. I don't like doing the show like this.
Well, but it depends what you're talking about. Like, if I'm talking about, let's say there's a situation going on right now. We've got two right now. One, Calumet City, and what was the other one I said where is it here? In Vernon Hills, okay? So keeping track of that through the night hours right now, I kind of feel like I should be on my feet because I'm waiting for
there's stuff going on.
Well, yeah, it's happening. It's happening right now.
Let's see what's gonna happen here.
It kind of makes me feel excited and, you know, it's news happening. But if I'm just sitting up here, it's like, you know, stretch and maybe I'll reach over, get a red vine over there or something. You know,
thank you for bringing in those red vines. They're very delicious.
Yeah, they are very good.
But I don't understand. So you were saying, I think you were saying on Patty's show that you ordered like three things of red vines.
Yeah, three tubs of red vines.
There's one left. Why would you put out all three?
I didn't put them out. I wasn't here Monday when they came. I told Stephanie, when it comes in, go ahead and open up the box and spread them around as she saw fit.
And she was a little red vine fairy just walking around handing out treats for deserving boys
just
and girls?
Smacking people on the head with a red vine.
Wow.
No, from what I understand, when I came in tonight, somebody said, yeah, they had everything right where you saw them on the news desk in here.
Out.
Because it's nerve center of the station right here. Everyone walks in and out. We've got two doors. We've got big windows. Everyone walks in and out on their way from their offices to the studios or whatever. So she must have put all three of them out, and because of the holiday, July 4th holiday, there were different people in and a lot of activity, and so we're down to one from three, so I ordered three more.
You're going to go bankrupt really quick.
I know. That's one of my downfalls. I like sharing, unfortunately.
And but it's all getting eaten when you're not even here. You're not even getting Red Vine credit.
That's okay. I don't care.
Oh, Roger.
No, I don't.
What good is giving and being generous if you're not getting a pat on the back for it?
I don't need a pat on the back. I just like sharing.
Oh, it's stop it.
Someone called me a mensch several years ago.
Mm-hmm. I never understood what exactly that is. A mensch is it's Yiddish, right?
Yeah.
Is it a good guy or
it's a good guy. Okay. Yeah. It's a good person. It could be a male or female, doesn't matter. And it's someone who does things for other people, makes connections between, like if one of my former students says, "Oh, you know, God, do you know anyone who does producing or of music or a booker or something or a publisher, this or that?" I go, "You know, I know a guy. I got a guy.
I know a guy.
I know a guy. Let me hook you up. Here's the information." And I try to make things happen to better people's lives.
So a mensch is almost a Jewish version of the Italian goodfella.
Oh, is that what that?
Well, I don't, okay. I don't exactly know, but you know, in Donnie Brasco, Brasco, it's actually he gives an explanation on what's the word he gives. Like, forget about it.
Forget about it.
Goodfellas.
Well, right.
He talks about
right.
He's a good fella. He's a good guy. He's one of
right
us.
Because they try to do things for people, right. but. Well, isn't there like something attached to that?
But the Jewish people aren't killing anybody. It's very different, probably, than the mafia.
Mm-hmm. All right, so here's a translation. This is from, I don't know who this is from, dictionary.
We're just reading random definitions.
Yeah, mensch, a person of integrity and honor.
Oh, well, that's very nice. See, when you hear mensch, if you don't know it, that doesn't sound like that's what it means. He's a mensch.
Right, it doesn't,
It doesn't sound very positive, just the sound of the word.
This, according to Leo Rostin, author of The Joys of Yiddish, a mensch is someone to admire and emulate, someone of noble character. The key to being a real mensch is nothing less than character, rectitude, dignity, a sense of what is right, responsible, decorous. The term is used as a high compliment, implying the rarity and value of that individual's quality. But see, I don't think I'm that. I just do it.
You're a good guy. We'll give you that. We'll give you that. It's fine. Yeah. It's fine. Yeah. Be a good guy.
So
there'll be a few of those left in the world.
Well, we need more.
Well, that's true. That is true.
How you been?
Good. That's right. I missed you guys last week, and I got to fill in for John. I got to be here in daylight hours.
How was that?
It was nice. It was nice to be here. It was fun. And although I'll tell you what, I know we've all, and I'm sorry everybody, because it's enough with the inside baseball and the whole move of the building. For God's sakes, we're still on the radio, and that's all we should care about. But parking at night, you and I have talked about quite a bit, because we used to have the lot. Now we got to find. And there's free parking overnight, depending on when you get here. So when I get here, if I can find a space on the street, it's great. The funny thing about this building is, on the west side of the building, what is this street that runs up north and south next to
it? I think it's Columbus. Is that Columbus? And south?
Whatever the street is next to this building.
I think so.
In front of our building, there is literally one paid parking spot. There's
no
spot
way.
For one. Have you noticed that?
No, I go right to my parking garage.
You got
to
go on the side of this building. You will laugh because there's 8 million signs on every street, and you got to read them all and like do the math and carry the one and figure out, wait a minute, can I park here or not?
Yeah, right.
But literally, you know, the green pay at the box signs?
Uh-huh, right.
There is one right in front of our building, and then like 2 feet to the right of it, there is a Hungarian consulate parking only, and then 2 feet north of it, there's like tow zone only. So literally, there's room for one car, and there's no parking box anywhere nearby. So I don't know. It's got to be a building. Or it's got to be nearby, but I don't see it. I don't know where it is. So I'm always thinking, this is like playing the lottery. I wonder if that spot will be open. It's never open. So far, it hasn't been. And then I'm not part of the consulate. Then there's like firemen only parking. There's like 8 million restrictions right in front of this building. And that one little spot that you roll the dice and pray, will it be there? No. And so then I go a couple buildings away. But during the daytime on Saturday, there's nothing. Like I was getting here probably at 9 a.m. because I was on for John at 10.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing anywhere nearby.
Yeah.
I ended up like three blocks over, and to pay to park for 2 hours on a Saturday morning, I don't do that much. I live in the burbs. During the week when I come down to my Black Dog Studios, I have a garage that I pay monthly. Mm-hmm. So I don't park on the street much, almost ever.
Okay.
Except for overnights, and that's free. So I don't really understand how much parking costs.
Yeah.
And I know it's like different costs, probably different parts of the city.
Yeah, it is. In fact, some of the lakefront stuff is zoned now. It depends where along the lakefront and how far west of the lakefront. But now zoned.
So the better area you get for parking or more in demand, they're charging more, right?
Yeah.
So I parked last week, and for 2 hours, it cost me $13.
What the?
Yeah. And that was like a few blocks away. I wasn't even like anywhere near here. I was like, oh my God, $13? I can't afford this.
I found my spot. Have I told you about my spot?
You told me it's in a garage, but can I ask how much are we paying for that?
12 hours.
Okay.
$20.
Still.
But I'm here longer than you.
You are, but that's a lot to shell out.
Well, but as far as covered.
That's nice. In the winter. Yeah, I guess, boy, I'm really
covered.
Gonna, I'm really
and
have a new deal
it's next to the pedway.
But it's closed in the middle of the night when you get
here,
isn't it?
No, not this part.
Oh, you can get to this building from where you park?
Yes, I can.
All right, well, then that's worthwhile. So good.
Yep, and it's not. It's about, you know how the walk was from the, over at the Tribune, from the parking lot up the ramp and then in the doorway?
Yeah.
It's about twice that long, that length.
That's not bad.
Not bad at all.
Oh, good.
It's out of the rain, out of the heat, out of the snow, out of the cold.
Good. 815 text, public transportation. Well,
but you still got to walk.
A bus stopping right in front of the building.
No. In fact, we have so much construction up where, for people who aren't aware, and there's Upper Wacker Drive, Lower Wacker Drive. We are at the eastern edge of Upper Wacker Drive. It ends in front of our building.
Yeah.
And there's no real easy way to kind of turn around or anything. And now they've got all this construction up at our end on the road and buildings. And it's very difficult to get around up here. Yeah. And it's busy because we've got hotels up here. So you've got a ton of cabs and Lyft and Uber drivers up in this area. It's active up here. And we got a like you said, the fire station is half a block away.
Yeah, the fire station's right nearby. Yeah. And but there are multiple levels of Wacker here, so I imagine there's more parking that I could find. But I don't know that I want to be two levels down on Wacker at 1 in the morning walking up here.
The mold people will come after you.
Yeah. Or the people drag racing down there. Isn't down?
Yeah, they do.
They do that,
the motorcyclists
right?
and the drag racers. Yeah, sure.
So lots of stuff going on.
Yeah.
So we're back at it till 5 a.m. Thanks for hanging out with us, everybody. Matt Bubala here with you on the Matt Bubala Show. 815 writes, love watching the live stream. And Jess is just teasing me about that because I shut all the lights down.
It looks nice. I like it.
I like broadcasting in the dark. And there's 18 monitors in here, so we're still pretty well lit.
Yes.
I can read everything just fine.
Yeah.
And now we can rear window outside.
Still got all that reflection in the windows.
You do have a bit, but I'll tell you what. So last week when I was doing John's show, you hear, they even have a promo about it now for Steve Cochran's show that about all these people in the building next to us and that they can see.
Oh, that's right.
These windows.
Yeah.
And I thought, boy, that really sounds like we're being pervs and we should stop doing that, right? Because it does. But then you get up here, and when I was here during the day, especially, I'd never, only a couple times I've been in here, I've been looking out this side that looks north where you see the Sheraton across the river.
Right.
And you see the NBC Tower. You can see the back end of our old Tribune Tower.
Mm-hmm.
And I've mostly looked that way. And then I'm listening to this promo when I was coming in to do John's show. And I was thinking, wait, where is this? So then I look out the other window here.
This is the west window.
If you look west, there's an apartment building right next to us. Mm-hmm. And we're 18 floors up. So you can see into, I don't know, floors like 14 through 21 over here.
Yeah.
And during the day especially.
Curtains are open.
You're just looking in on everybody. And at night, at 1 in the morning,
mm-hmm.
A few people have their lights
on.
Some
late workers.
Some don't.
Yeah.
Or it's Friday night. People just staying up, happy to be out, whatever. Yeah.
And now if anyone starts using Studio A on the east side, there's the hotel.
Oh,
on the east side
right
with a lot of windows facing that studio. Mm-hmm.
Well, and the Sheraton's across the street. It's across the river, so that's further away. You're not going to see as much. But
well, you forgot to bring your binoculars.
Now that would be really bad form if I did that, right? That would look bad.
Yeah,
you're walking in with the binoculars.
Mm-hmm.
Just every commercial break, you're kind of what's going on in the city?
I want to look at the boats on the river.
Maybe. To make nobody feel bad about that, we should just have a studio pair of binoculars. Just in case something happened news-wise, and you needed to look, up Columbus Avenue towards the Hancock or something. You never know.
Sure.
There could be breaking news that we
want
to take a look and see.
Well, you know,
what the traffic is.
In the old days, the traffic reporting stations were at the top of the Hancock Center.
Yeah.
And they had binoculars all over the place. Yeah. So, in fact, actually, it would look classier if we had a very expensive telescope.
You know what we should get?
And we could pretend we're looking at the stars over the city.
Why don't we just get the little lookout things that they have, like, at the top of the Empire State Building?
You got to put your quarter in.
And it's got, like, the big face with the two eyes. You got to lean up against it.
I could just hear him somewhere.
That would be
someone
okay,
looking at.
Right?
Hey, look at the ka-chuck. Oh, I need quarters.
Too funny. 312-981-7200. Some texts are coming in. Send them along to us. Jump on the phone whenever you want. Later in the show, I'm very curious to see what you guys think about this. Pursuing your passion. If you tell somebody, you got to pursue your passion. Are you giving them good advice? A new study says maybe not, unless you're doing it correctly. Coming up after the 1:30 news, though, Chris Gebhardt from, is it NASASpaceflight.com, Jess? Am I getting that right? NASASpaceflight.com? Yes, Jess says. NASASpaceflight.com. We got a Mars rover stuck in a sandstorm, and I'm not going to make fun of it, but we need to find out what the hell the Space Force is going to be and what's going to happen there. I'm not going to bash anything here. I want a real, like,
I want a uniform like Flash Gordon.
I'll tell you what, I've got a lot of, like, little bits I want to make about the Space Force. But in reality, and I don't know what exactly is intended, but we probably do need a Space Force in because I think everybody thinks of, like, you know, we're going to go blow up asteroids and stuff, but we probably do need more in the area of maintaining and correcting or, governing everything that is in space right now. I wonder, and I don't know how much Chris will know about this, but are we headed to problems because all of these countries are putting so much stuff up in space? We talked a lot last year about the Chinese space station that came down, unfortunately, just right in the Pacific Ocean. No fun at all. But there's going to be more and more and more of that stuff going on. So I wonder if Chris was going to make a space force, what are our immediate needs in space? If it's, you know, to go blast aliens, then that doesn't make a lot of sense. But I imagine there is more needed to protect the Earth from what we are doing in space and everything we're putting out there. So we'll find out a little bit about that and have some fun with you along the way. 312-981-7200. You may call, you may text, join the show, be with us. Matt Bubala with you on 720 WGN. Texter asks if we're going to talk about the kids trapped in the cave. Yes, we are looking up stories on that. We're trying to effort a reporter on that. We'll see if we could do something before 5 a.m. For sure, that story is getting scary and just more and more fascinating. So we will update you on that when we can. Chicago is hosting the ultimate month-long food festival this August. Visit ctfoodbowl.com to get your seat at the table. Roger, let's see, from 815, somebody sent me a picture of a definition of mensch. It says, from Fred Kagos, a dictionary of Yiddish slang and idioms.
Mm-hmm.
And it says mensch, a special man or person. This word involves a whole philosophy of life. Mensch means a human being in the moral and ethical sense, not merely a person, but a person with worth and dignity, one who can be respected. So, Roger, you are our mensch, yes.
Well, thank you. Let's move on. I'm embarrassed by it. I am. I just
you're
do
not
it.
That much of a mensch. I'm not praising you that much.
No, but
just a tiny little mensch. Tiny little mensch. So you're a red vine mensch.
I'm a red. The rest of you,
take it or leave it. Take him or leave him. Hey, you know, I'm sorry. I don't know if I mentioned this with Patty, but I'm really hoping we can get on the phone before the end of the show. Our friend Mark Shipper.
Oh yeah.
He used to write for D. All right. Who is he?
Well, he's traveling all over the world. Isn't that the guy who travels all over the world?
No, that's Wally.
Huh?
That's Wally.
Where's Wally?
Well, I don't know, but that's what I'm talking about.
It was a rhetorical question.
Just says Wally's actually home this weekend.
Well, really?
So hopefully Wally's not listening. Hopefully he's sleeping in his own bed and enjoying, you know, actually being home for once.
Or maybe he's got to get up early for another flight.
I wonder how, if he's home, so he's gone for like weeks at a time.
Yeah.
And then he's suddenly home for two nights. It's got to be impossible for him to get on any sense of a time clock, right?
He probably
is listening.
Heck yes.
No, Mark Shipper used to write for DNA Info. We talked to him last year at this time because he was at the running of the Bulls. And he's back there. He's there again.
Wait, didn't he get hurt?
No, was it his friend who got hurt? No.
This was someone who got hurt.
No, it's
not.
Or he
reported on someone who got hurt.
Well, probably. You might be remembering Cochran's show because he's talked to some guys that have taken it over there. But no, Mark was there. He ran. I don't believe he got hurt, although we'll have to check with him. I don't recall that. But he's back there again. He was working on a documentary, and I don't know if that's done yet or if they're still working on it. So hopefully we'll check in with him. If we don't get him this week, we'll try for sure next week.
Okay. Do you know if he went back this year or?
He's there right now.
Oh, yeah? Okay. Yeah, all right.
That's the thing.
I'm trying to pay attention.
Keep up with the show. You praise a man for red vines?
Red vines going to my head.
I guess. Are you ready for the news?
I think I am.
Okay. 136 on 720 WGN. Good morning, everybody. Matt Bubala here with you. Thanks for staying up overnight with us. We'll take you all the way through till 5 a.m. when Orion will be here with the morning show. Max also chipping in, as always. Our friend Chris Gebhardt from NASASpaceflight.com joins us on the phone right now. Hey, Chris, how are you?
I'm doing good, Matt. How about yourself? How was your holiday?
It was very nice. How about you?
Very nice and quiet.
And quiet, good. I think, was the last time we talked when the Chinese space station was coming down? I think it was, right?
Yes, it was. It was indeed, a few months ago.
Nobody won any tacos.
Nobody won any tacos. So pumped about that.
Yeah, me too. Me too. I promised I would fly you in if it happened, and so it didn't work out. But that's okay. I guess nobody got hurt is what we should take out of it. But it's always fun to hope for something more exciting. Let's catch up on everything that's going on in the world of, outer space exploration. The Mars rover is in a little bit of trouble right now. Is that what's going on?
Yes, one of them is. NASA and humanity, because there are only two and they're both from NASA, we currently have two rovers on the surface of Mars, one named Opportunity, one named Curiosity. And the one that's in trouble is Opportunity. And so here's kind of what happened. So back at the end of May, an orbiting spacecraft around Mars called the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter picked up the first hint of a very localized dust storm that was north of Opportunity's location, but moving quickly south toward the rover. They alerted Opportunity's control teams and science teams, who began planning for exactly what they would do in terms of operations with the rover if the dust storm became a problem. And dust storms, despite what we might think because of popular culture, aren't actually all that common on Mars. The last global dust storm that was there was in 2007, and the one before that was in 2001. So we went quite a long period between these dust storm events, and the one in 2007 actually really helped us understand exactly how Opportunity would respond given severities of dust storms. But the problem is that this dust storm is much more severe than the one that we encountered in 2007.
Okay, couple quick questions about the rovers, Opportunity and Curiosity.
Yes.
How long have they been on Mars now and working?
Yes, so Curiosity is the newest one, and Curiosity landed in August of 2012, and is still going very, very strong. Curiosity is powered by a nuclear power source inside the rover, so it does not rely on any power from the sun to operate.
Okay.
Opportunity is actually the one that's been there longer. So Opportunity landed in January of 2004 for what was only supposed to be a three-month mission. And 14 and a half years later, that little rover is still going strong.
You know, I got to say, Chris,
at least it was until the dust storm got there.
I'm starting to think that NASA pads things in the way that the airlines do. Like when I was on a flight just this week to New York, and it was like, we're taking off at 6 a.m. and we land at 9 a.m. But you know, you land like 40 minutes early, and it's like they build in all this time so that you're on time no matter how bad things go. And sometimes when things last 14 years long, you know, it's a three-month mission. 14 years later, here we go. You're like, all right, were you guys lying a little bit? Did you think it was going to last a little longer than 3 months? No, it's just amazing. We were that good at it. Who knew?
So it is a little bit of both, actually.
Okay.
So Opportunity actually went to Mars with a twin rover called Spirit. And Spirit also greatly outlasted its 90-day mission, but succumbed to the Martian environment back in 2009 when it got stuck in the sand going into a Martian winter period, and its solar panels weren't able to generate enough power to keep its systems and its heaters and its clocks alive. So Spirit didn't survive the 2009 Martian winter, but Opportunity did. So in a way, NASA always builds their spacecraft to far out sea, exceed what they anticipate the mission duration to be. That way, if conditions aren't quite what they expect, if conditions are rougher, you've overbuilt your craft so that you can still get that full mission success that you're going for, which in Opportunity's case was that 90-day mission. And since then, it's really been a combination of how robustly the rovers were built, specifically Opportunity, some very, very fortunate solar panel cleaning events from wind and dust devils that have come over the rover and cleaned off its solar panels, allowing it to generate a lot more power than we have anticipated it would be at this point in its mission. And very favorable locations. Opportunity is currently on a crater on Mars, and on a side of that crater that angles its solar panels northward toward the sun, where the sun would be in summer. And we are currently in a Martian summer where opportunity is. So it's been luck, and it's also been a real testament to how the engineers have built this rover, that it's lasted so long.
How big are these rovers? Like, are they the size of a small car? Or are they way smaller than that?
Yeah, so Curiosity is about the size of a small car. If you think of those little smart cars that only fit two people, they look like you cut a car in half, basically. Curiosity is about that size, and Opportunity is much smaller. Opportunity would be maybe the size of, like, a large armchair, basically, in your living room, in terms of, like, the solar panels and everything, and then you've got to account for the wheels. But they're about that size.
I got to ask you, Chris, when we look at, you know, everything that's going on with NASA right now, I believe that President Trump is still on board with getting to Mars, right? Isn't that the current course they're still on, is human exploration of Mars? And then there's all this private groups that, if they ever get the money, maybe are going to try to send somebody to Mars. I think everything with that's still really up in the air, kind of, right?
Yes. So both NASA and SpaceX, which is the main commercial company that has major plans for Mars colonization, Mars is definitely on that list. For SpaceX, that is the goal. That is SpaceX's stated goal, to begin colonization of Mars in the 2020 decade, in less than 10 years or about 10 years' time. For NASA, that timeline's a little bit different and a little bit more ambiguous to exactly when Mars would happen for the U.S. government and the U.S. Federal Space Agency. Mars was the direct goal with the previous administration under President Obama, and with the current administration with President Trump, there is more of a focus for NASA first on going back to the moon and building a space station out near lunar orbit and using that space station to help facilitate more exploration away from Earth, and also exploration and, you know, you could kind of think of it as like day trips. They'd be longer, but that's a good analogy of day trips from this lunar station down to the surface of the moon.
All right. Well, let me ask why. So I also see all these commercials all the time about the advances in robotics and robots that are doing so many different things these days, and the amazing lengths we've gone, you know, with robots. So why, I know it's very sexy to send humans to Mars, but why wouldn't we, I would imagine we have the technology to build robots that could land on Mars, walk around on Mars, start building structures on Mars, so that when humans eventually, when everything got easier about that, actually got there, I would think, I know it's never the same as actually having a human being there, but couldn't we start in some ways colonizing Mars or colonizing the moon with artificial intelligence?
Yeah, that's a good question, and that's sort of exactly what NASA's approach has been. So if you lay out all of the robotic exploration missions that NASA has sent to the surface of Mars, including one we actually just launched back in May that will get there later this year and land on the surface, they're all building upon one another, and they're all building toward this goal of helping us understand the Martian environment by robotic precursor missions, is what NASA calls them, before we actually send a human being. Now, in terms of robots that could, you know, walk around and build structures for us, you know, I would say perhaps that would be a possibility, but one of the things that NASA and SpaceX are both looking at least in terms of the initial colonization efforts, is pre-staging all of this stuff that's pre-built, and we land on the Martian surface sort of in modular form. So if you think about, like, your house, right, it would be the equivalent of sending the living room separate from the kitchen, separate from the bedrooms, and then it's all there on Mars. So you have very little, once humans get there, to do in terms of connecting all those structures together and having these large habitable volumes on the surface of the planet. And for SpaceX, their huge colonization ship called the BFR, which stands for Big Falcon Rocket, is actually a huge modular element that people would live in once we get to the surface of Mars. So in this case, you know, sending robots ahead of time to build our structures isn't as efficient as landing all of those structures, some with humans in them already directly on the surface of Mars and then living on them.
What would be the most difficult thing if we did colonize Mars? Is it making sure there's oxygen, making sure there's water, growing food? If, you know, if we're talking long term, people there for 3 to 5 years where it's we can't just send the supplies. What would be the most difficult part of figuring out how to sustain life there?
So a lot of it would be the sustainability of food. Oxygen and water we can actually pull and manufacture from the Martian atmosphere. Mars's atmosphere is abundant in carbon dioxide. So we can pull that carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and make oxygen to breathe. And we can also then use some of the elemental hydrogen and some of the other elements that are present in abundance on Mars to make drinking water for ourselves. So we can really use a lot of the resources that are present on Mars. It's what NASA and SpaceX call in situ resource utilization. And it's part of what these robotic precursor missions are helping us understand in terms of what's there and what we can do. But from the food element, you can't grow food that is good for human consumption and necessary for human consumption in the Martian soil. It doesn't have the nutrients and the microbes and everything that we need for our produce to grow. And, you know, you also, you know, can't send cows and chickens out to graze in the field because they don't exist there. So a lot of it would be that sustainability of the food supply. There have been some technological advancements in terms of 3D printing food, which sounds incredibly weird, but but happens. It's not quite like the Star Trek replicator where you can just go up to it and, you know, say, you know, I want a pepperoni pizza. But it can print you a pizza.
But it would still need the elements or the, you know, the molecules that we can't grow there easily, right?
Right. And so a lot of it would be bringing a lot of it with us and making sure that we've stockpiled enough there so that if a resupply mission were to fail, we wouldn't be in, you know, really bad, you know, territory.
Well, does that come down to
SpaceX is also talking about greenhouses. So you're also talking about having to bring soil with you to grow all of this stuff. And So part of that would be the food process, but the other part of it would, and the really important part from my perspective would be the psychological issues that come along with that, because, you know, we've gotten very used to, you know, in just the last few years, being able to pick up our phone and, you know, video chat with someone on the other side of the planet. We can video chat with our astronauts live with no time delay on the International Space Station right now. But when you start talking about Mars, that signal and that audio can take anywhere from 5 minutes to 15 minutes to reach Mars, depending on where Earth and Mars are in their respective orbits. So anyone who goes isn't going to have instantaneous contact with Earth. Those communications are going to be limited. Yeah. And I mean, let's face it, when you take a car trip with someone, they can start to get on your nerves. You know, imagine going with 100 people to another planet, and these are the 100 people you will live the rest of your lives with if you're going to colonize the planet. There's a lot of psychological health issues that we're working through, and we're, you know, really trying to understand in terms of isolation and separation.
Yeah, I can imagine. You mentioned the greenhouses, and I would think hydroponics too, right? Aren't there a lot of things we can grow completely in water?
Yes, and not just in water, but also in these really cool experiments that are going on station are testing exactly how we can grow vegetables in soilless conditions and not just immersing the roots in water, but how do you develop these types of systems where you might not have to bring all the soil with you? You might be able to grow these things without soil, without submerging them in water. And they're really cool experiments trying to figure out exactly how we can grow food and produce in the most efficient way with the least amount of water possible, and how we can give the plants all the nutrients that they need that they normally take from the soil when you might not have it there.
So what's your best guess? If you were going to take a guess right now when a human sets foot on Mars, what year would you put that in?
Ooh, that is a good question.
Because 2020 has been the year that first started getting thrown around, but there's no way, right?
Yeah, no. 2020, like the physical year 2020 is a no. So what SpaceX's current plan is, and they are the company that has the plan with dates. So their plan is to send a few of their BFR, Big Falcon rockets, to Mars as precursors, loaded with supplies, no humans, but just loaded with all the supplies that the initial colonists will need in 2022. And that would be followed by the first 100 to 200 colonists following about 26 months later in 2024 during the next Earth-Mars interplanetary launch window. Now, that is the schedule that they have in terms of if everything with development of the BFR goes well. They have just started building the first subscale version of that rocket for testing. They're breaking ground on the rocket's production facility out at the Port of Los Angeles in California. So a lot of people view that timeline to be incredibly optimistic. But what I'll say about that is it's at least a timeline. You know, we're no longer talking about, you know, a mission to Mars being 20 years off when it always seems to be 20 years off every time you talk to one another. There's a company out there now saying within the next decade, we'll have people on Mars. You know, SpaceX has a way of saying things that sound completely unfeasible when you hear them and making them a reality. Yeah, three years ago, people didn't think that we'd be launching rockets and returning the rocket stages to land on barges in the ocean or back at their launch site under rocket power. And it's become so commonplace with SpaceX now that when they don't do it, when they expend a booster, people are upset at it now. So,
and I know there were a lot of different there were a lot of different plans for Mars. SpaceX's, which sounds most realistic now, if they send 100 people in 2024, how long are those people staying for? What is their plan on? Because there was one company that it was you're going there to live the rest of your life out. There's no return ticket. What is SpaceX's plan?
I forget what the name of that company was. Yeah, but and
I think that was Space
and
One.
Just side note before I answer that question, Mars One. Yeah, if my memory is right, there were well over a million people who signed up for that one-way journey to Mars.
Yeah, and they got down to 100
with Mars One.
Yeah, one's become a friend of the show. We talk to all the time, and they narrowed it down to 100 people. Of course, they need a few billion dollars. They're short right now to make that a reality, but. But yeah, lots of people like, yeah, we'll do that. And but that's not SpaceX's plan, right?
Not entirely. So SpaceX has talked about this being a true colonization effort in terms of, you know, if we think about, you know, the colonization of the Americas from the European side, where, you know, if you boarded that colonization ship and you were coming here, you were coming here. You were making that commitment. You know, and that a majority of you would not go back after that. And that is a large part of the plan that you would be signing up to go live on Mars and help build this colony and help establish it. Now, under SpaceX's plan with their BFR rockets, they are built and designed. And what SpaceX is also talking about in terms of technology is harvesting some of the fuel that those rockets will need and making the fuel for those rockets right there on Mars so that they can take off again. They can come back to Earth for supply runs to ferry people back and forth. So SpaceX sort of has a both approach to that, you know, there would be a lot of people going to stay and to live out the rest of their lives on Mars, but there would also be people who could sign up to be tourists and go on one rocket and come back on the next, you know, when the launch window is aligned. So it would kind of be both. And I think that's a very interesting dynamic to set up that you would want that tourism element to say, hey, if you can afford it, go for it. You know, come visit Mars for a couple of years and then go back home and help support the Mars economy, which I just have to say, I think it's really cool that in 2018, we can say that we're starting to talk about lunar economies and Mars economies and how this would actually work, and not in a theoretical realm, but a practical realm.
Well, one last question, Chris. Speaking of economies, how does SpaceX make money doing this? I know that they're sending satellites into space, so they're getting some money from companies, but the Mars thing, that's really just more of a look how cool this is, right?
I wouldn't say that, no. So the Mars initiatives, the development of the rocket and the colonization equipment and plan are being funded largely in-house by SpaceX. So, and the way they're doing that is these, returning boosters to land on barges or on land at their launch sites and refurbishing them and flying them again is a huge part of that plan. That way SpaceX builds one booster that you can fly now with the Block 5 variant of the Falcon 9, you can fly it up to 100 times or more. And customers keep paying for those rides, and SpaceX keeps getting the money for that. So they're making money off of that. SpaceX is also developing in-house a satellite-based internet system that they plan to start launching sometime within the next 2 years. The first two demo satellites actually went up earlier this year and have performed quite well and above expectations from what Elon has said online. This is going to be close to a 12,000 satellite network that will provide internet services for people who sign up for it, no matter where you are on the planet, in the middle of the ocean, in a part of a remote desert that doesn't have any type of cellular service or anything like that. And that service is also going to be a huge part of how they pay for the development of all of this colonization technology.
Didn't we have that once before with Iridium satellites?
Oh, we do still currently have it with Iridium satellites. And I'm glad you actually bring up Iridium, because they are the next customer launching with SpaceX later this month on the 20th of July. But Iridium is also an internet-based telecommunication service. So they have mobile data, but they also primarily do internet phones and internet push-to-talk services. So they're huge in the satellite phone business right now, and looking to expand into other areas. But if you sort of think about it, what SpaceX is really trying to do is to say, like, look, there's all of this technology that we have, and yes, you know, satellite phones and these, you know, satellite push-to-talk services come in really handy for what they are currently used for in scientific research or natural disaster relief efforts. Iridium was actually huge in the recovery effort that's still ongoing down in Puerto Rico from Hurricane Maria last year. But what SpaceX is saying is there's no reason we can't take that same technology and say, hey, are you fed up with your internet provider? Like, what if you live in an area where you just want a different option? Hey, yeah, we could provide you this option. And because the satellites continuously come overhead, you're never going to lose that service. Or maybe more importantly, like, what happens if you live in an area that's prone to natural disasters that can take out the power? Well, you have a satellite-based internet service that runs off of a solar-powered receiver, small little receiver attached to your house. If the power goes out, you still have internet. You still have a way to contact people after that.
And this would
that's
be
sort of what SpaceX's business model is with the internet-based.
And would that be insanely fast internet as well?
Yes, they are. They strive to make it just as fast or faster than the than any of the current providers that you've got out on the market.
Well, that sounds fascinating. Chris Gebhardt from NASASpaceflight.com. It's always good to check in with you. Thanks so much for jumping on the phone.
My pleasure. Anytime, Matt.
All right, Chris. We'll talk again soon. Chris Gebhardt, NASASpaceflight.com. Let's take a quick break, then we'll get the news next. 720 WGN. Good morning, everybody. Matt Bobala with you here, 720 WGN. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. It's also the text in line. So, Roger, during your newscast, excuse me, I've been reading about this Thai rescue operation. Soccer team.
Yeah, all the kids down there and the dive team down there.
12 to 16-year-old boys. Is that mm-hmm. what the ages? 12 boys down there.
Right. I don't think they're all 16, they're within that age.
Ages 11 to 16.
Yeah.
25-year-old coach.
Mm-hmm.
They are 2.5 miles from the entrance to this underground cave system.
And it's not a straight line.
It is not a straight line. There is, looks like, at least, I've got a graphic on CNN.com mm-hmm. where I'm reading the latest story. And it looks like there's a couple different areas. So it's monsoon season, mm-hmm. and there were heavy rains while they were in there, and the cave system flooded.
Right.
And there's one part that's a very narrow passage. I don't know how easy it was for them to walk through it or not, but it's flooded because it dips down into like a V-shaped pattern. They had to go downhill, then they had to go uphill as they were walking.
Mm-hmm.
And now that is completely flooded, and it's difficult to swim through. And divers have gotten to them, right?
Right.
But one, an ex-Navy SEAL from, or whatever the Thai version, I guess, of a SEAL is, who was bringing oxygen tanks to them, he ran out of water himself. Former
oxygen, yeah.
Right, yeah. Ran out of oxygen and died. Former Sergeant Saman Kunan, a Thai ex-SEAL, died at 2 a.m. Friday as he returned from an operation to deliver oxygen tanks to the cave where the boys are located. The 38-year-old ran out of air while underwater, an official said.
And because the section that the kids and the other divers are in, that is running out of oxygen now.
Right.
Because there's water blocking airflow in there because of what you described. And they're trying to pump water out, but that's not going very well because it's still raining and the water is still coming in.
Filling back in.
Yeah. And there's some very many, if not all of the boys, can't swim. They can't dive.
They're practicing diving, it says.
Oh, okay.
Which is just crazy. I mean, some of this story is just crazy. Let me go back to some of this from CNN. Now their rescue options include possibility of buddy dives, where an experienced diver would take boys one at a time.
Mm-hmm. But then the kids still have to, in that one section you described, and I think there's another one, where they still have to go underwater. They have to hold their breath and swim, or at least be used to an air tank or sharing an air tank. Now, as they try to swim under that section.
Now, they've got video of the boys in the cave.
Okay.
How is that possible? How many people have gotten to them?
Microwave. You can... I don't know if there have been people going back and forth. I don't know if members of these SEAL teams have been going back and forth to try to bring in more supplies. I have not been keeping up to date on that detail. I've just been kind of cursory checking on the current condition.
New video of the youth soccer team. Hold on, I'm reading from this.
Okay.
New video of the youth soccer team trapped in caves in Thailand has been released. It shows the boys wrapped in foil blankets as Thai Navy SEALs stay with them overnight.
Mm-hmm. And they've also written letters, apparently.
And they've
the coach of the team and the boys have written letters, and the coach of the team, at least according to the report I have here, saying that he will do everything in his power to make sure the kids get out safely.
So they've got foil blankets they were able to get in there
mm-hmm.
for them. They seem to have plenty of room. They're being treated for injuries, so they're doing okay, except for this whole oxygen part. One of the plans was to keep them there for like 4 months until everything dried up and they could just walk out.
But you can't. They're running out of oxygen.
Well, right, but that was the plan until they
realized. And food and everything else, yeah.
Well, they could get food to them.
Well, so, yeah,
I mean, but what doesn't make any sense is Navy SEALs are getting in there. People are in there treating
them. But they
can
dive. The Navy SEALs are trained for this. These guys are trained for this. They have the supplies and everything. Now they're going to be trapped in this cave area, this open area with these kids, trying to train them to do what they've had years of training to do.
So the group was located by two British divers on July 2nd. But it's been too risky to rescue. I know this. I'm not being flippant about this at all.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not making jokes about this because this is terrible and tragic, and I want them all to survive. But when it just doesn't make sense that all these guys can get in, these Navy SEALs are all in there with them, but we can't get the kids out. If all these Navy SEALs can get in,
mm-hmm.
and I know they've tried this, but if swimmers are diving through and getting in, how can they not carry a thin hose with them long enough so that they can just pump oxygen into this? I know they're trying that. How is that not working?
Maybe they have tried.
They have.
I don't know.
They have tried.
And so then,
I mean, it's being difficult, but I don't understand how if a human being can get through and dive through this,
mm-hmm.
that they can't get some stuff in here.
It's not, like you said before, it's not an easy trip through that section. I saw a diagram earlier today, and I'm like, well, this is ridiculous. Of the twists and turns, the ups and downs that they have to go through. There are sections where it's clear. Then there are dips that are covered in water. It's treacherous.
It's difficult.
Yeah,
I agree, and I can see where it'd be difficult to get the boys out, and very dangerous because if it gets thin as they're trying mm-hmm. to swim through this, and it's pitch black and everything. And it says in this video that. They're teaching the boys how to dive. They're practicing with full face diving masks. So they're seeing if they could train them to do that and they could take them out one by one.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to find or drill another cave opening or draining the tunnels in some way. But as you said, the problem is they keep filling back up.
Yeah.
So there's not much that they can do about all that right now. But it makes me think of like an old movie. It makes me think of like think of an old movie where they're diving underwater and they got the huge suit on, not
right.
the diving suits, but like the old ones where the big metal mask where they look
right.
almost like a
the
robot.
Huge helmets that you with the cross section metal part and the glass. Yeah,
we can't bring those.
The weighted
in,
boots.
Put them in each of those and have them go through.
No, first of all, those are too heavy. Second of all, you can't maneuver in those. They're not walking. They have to duck down. They have to swim through the flooded sections. That you can't put them in those things because one, they're claustrophobic. Two, what if one of the tubes rips as you're pulling them forward? What if the air, you have to run air tubes into those things. You have to pump air into them. Then they have to be pressurized.
On Friday, Thai Navy SEAL Chief Rear Admiral, I apologize, a name that there's no way I'm going to pronounce correctly, said oxygen levels in the cave had dropped to 15%, a level that one Thai medic said posed a serious risk of hypoxia, the same condition that causes altitude sickness. Governor Asatino Korn said air is a major issue, but added that UK experts had confirmed the conditions in the chamber where the children are located were, quote, all right. The kids are still able to walk around, play around comfortably. If there is heavy rain and the situation is not good, we will try. Authorities originally said the safest thing is to just let monsoon season pass in October. When water levels had subsided enough, they could just walk out. Could you imagine if you're stuck in this cave and they're like, yeah, you know what? This sucks, but just hang on. In October, it's only a few months away. We're already in July. You got most of July left. You got August. You got September. And then boom, just walk right out.
Yeah, there's no guarantee.
There is no guarantee.
There's no guarantee that they won't run out of air. There's no guarantee that the flood water won't increase and come into their area. There's no guarantee that you're going to be able to get these expert trained divers in and out of there continuously during that time period.
One recovery strategy that rescuers have been pursuing includes fitting their group with full face oxygen masks and accompanying them on a long, dangerous swim through the narrow pitch black tunnels. The group is learning to dive, but they're not yet ready. It takes even the most experienced divers up to 5 hours to swim through jagged, narrow channels from where the boys are to safety outside. The UK divers who first reached the boys described their dive as gnarly and full of tight passages submerged in low visibility water.
Yep.
Rescue teams above ground have drilled more than 100 holes in a bid to find a route to the trapped cave, but it doesn't look promising. U.S. officials said a plan to route oxygen into the chamber where the boys are was also called off due to challenges of routing cable through the cave system. Then they talk about the Navy SEAL who died.
Mm-hmm.
The huge operation to rescue the group involves scores of Thai Navy SEALs, in addition to experts and volunteer divers from parts of Europe and Asia, as well as Australia and the U.S. Billionaire inventor and entrepreneur Elon Musk said engineers from his SpaceX and Boring Company were headed to Thailand to see if they could help. So I imagine he wants to drill some holes in there and see if they can't get in there.
I don't know how he's going to do it.
The members of the Wild Boar soccer team were reported missing 2 weeks ago after they didn't return from an outing after soccer practice. They entered the cave during fine weather, but became trapped when a sudden downpour flooded the narrow tunnels. 12 boys and their coach were found deep inside the cave by two British cave divers on Monday, perched on a rock slab above floodwaters after 9 days without food or fresh water. Rescue teams have been pumping millions of liters of water from the cave in an attempt to drain the cave, but the impending weekend rains threaten to undermine the work. Thailand's monsoon season runs from July to October, and while the past few days have been relatively dry, the long-term forecast is rain for months. And I've heard, and it's not in this story, but I've heard that like they shouldn't have been in there.
Oh, in the first place?
Well, that they ignored certain warnings, things like that. During monsoon season, you should be walking 2.5 miles back in the system, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
They're 2.5 miles back. Texter from 847 says, it's over 2 miles. You can't get a hose back that far. Well, I don't believe that at all. I mean, you need a 2-mile-long hose.
Well, you need a bunch of hoses that when hooked up, they're 2 miles. But maybe that kind of system is not readily available.
Maybe, but let's think about this. We literally have cables under the ocean that go from the U.S. to Europe, right? We do.
Those were specially made, and it took years to make those.
I understand, but let's not say can't.
Well, no, I understand.
We can. We just it's
but you weren't dealing with trapped human beings when you were running those cables under the ocean.
But all I'm saying is if we can drag cables from New York to London, we could get oxygen for 2.5 miles. If we you're telling me that we don't have plans. We've had we've had miners trapped, maybe not 2.5 miles underground, but deep underground where we've done things. There have to be systems, emergency systems in the world for things such as people trapped underground that get oxygen.
Well, the reason why those, as you say, miners trapped underground, why it is so urgent to get there is there have been cave-ins, and those emergency or contingency plans are unusable because of the cave-in. That's why those situations are so desperate, because their oxygen is being cut off in spite of all the precautions that the mining industry has taken to make sure that workers are safe if there is a cave-in. There's things you just can't plan for, and then you have to scramble. Miners are trapped.
Untrue. There's things you can't plan for. There's always things you can plan for.
Well,
and being trapped is one of the things. And I think they need to turn to mining companies on what they would do in this situation. Let's check in with Joe in Downers Grove. Good morning, Joe. How are you? You're on 720 WGN.
Pretty good, Matt. Hey, to the other point raised, I heard 3 miles in and 3,000 feet to drill through the top of that mountain to get any kind of resources to them. My question is, it relates to the gene pool, if you will. What in the world possessed the leader of that football team, beginning of the monsoon season, you know, blah, 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 going to that depth in a very intricate cave system? You know, it just boggles the mind, myself.
That's a really good question, because that's what I've heard, is that there is flooding. You know, it's monsoon season, and they shouldn't have been going that far back. From what I've read, the soccer team, there's some players that didn't go on the trip, that they do this all the time. It's kind of a team-building thing. We practice 15, 20 hours a week. These are good team-building exercises. We go on these trips, and a couple of kids didn't go, but they're saying, hey, we trust our coach with our life, and we don't blame him for anything here. But, you know, it's a 25-year-old guy, and I'm 46. I still make stupid decisions all the time, so I can understand where he's like, it's not going to rain today. We'll be fine. I was just in here yesterday, and then suddenly it rains for a couple hours. You wouldn't think that these caves are going to flood. But I also have heard from friends, and I haven't found in a story yet, that there were warnings that they should not have been in there. They shouldn't have been going where they went. So, you know.
Matt, I agree with your concept totally and wholeheartedly, you know. You know, team spirit, esprit de corps, that's the Marine Corps' bias, be all and send all, if you will. But nevertheless, it's almost the same scenario we see a lot of today. It gets back to the gene pool again. You cross the border illegally, and you get your family separated. What do you expect to happen when you take a risk that shouldn't be taken, if you will? With crossing the border, you know what the result is. You know, people have borders. The United States has borders.
Joe, you took quite a jump here on me.
Yeah, really, but it's the same concept. you know, 25-year-old guy leading a football team. I agree. He's trying to establish esprit de corps, and the kids trust him with the, you know, undoubtedly, if you will. But nevertheless, you look at the concept of monsoon season approaching. Okay, that's a no-brainer.
I understand, but listen, you and I don't live there. We don't know what it's like. Tell me there aren't things that you and I as Americans do all the time. Do we jaywalk all the time? I don't. Maybe you don't, Joe. I do all the time. I'll jaywalk because I don't see a car coming. I think it's fine. I'm just going to cross right here. The day I get hit by a car, you're going to be calling into the replacement show and saying, you know, what is Matt thinking? We've been told for years not to jaywalk. There's cars going 50 miles an hour down the road. Here he is walking. What does he think is going to happen? I think it's more one of those things where it's like one of those things where there's signs, there's warnings. They tell us all the time, don't do this, and yet we do this. How many times do you burn the roof of your mouth when you eat something hot? You know it's hot. You know you shouldn't be eating it yet. You should be blowing on it, giving it a minute, but you do it. I look at this a little more like that, and the whole border crossing thing is a different area that we could talk about. But I don't think it was the same thing like you thought. I'm going to take this risk, and whatever happens, happens. I assume this guy's 25 years old, probably walks these caves all the time. It's monsoon season, but he lives in Thailand, and he knows, you know, this or that, or he's been in there in these months before, and it's been fine, and probably just wasn't thinking or wasn't being as precautious as sometimes we need to be.
Well, I'll grant you that. You know, he might have been a native, and, you know, the first thing that confused me is they're calling this guy a SEAL. And then they clarified it, saying he's a, you know, native SEAL. So I thought initially he was a volunteer from our SEAL team, SEAL Team 6, yeah. Whatever, you know.
Yeah, no, they have Thai SEALs, apparently.
Yeah, apparently so.
I always thought that was a wholly American thing. I didn't know that other countries' military had things called SEALs. But I guess
same connotation,
did.
Right. Yeah. So I'll grant you that. Let's hope he was a local and said, gee whiz, I've been through here a million times, and even though I'm only 25 years old, I know it's normally safe, and typhoon season, you know, forget about it. We'll get in and get out right
yeah.
in a hurry.
We'll only be in there for a couple hours. It'll be fine.
Yeah, amen. Okay.
This is why I don't lead expeditions anywhere with the team as a coach.
Good
I don't
advice,
want to be that
kid.
Guy. Thanks so much for calling in, Joe. We appreciate it. You have a great weekend. 312-981-7200. Call, text, jump on in here. Matt Bubala with you. 720 WGN.
Yes.
Today is or yesterday was, Jess? Yesterday, Jess says, was International Kissing Day? All right. 312-981-7200. Matt Bubala here with you on 720 WGN. We've been talking for the last 20 minutes or so about the soccer team that's trapped in the caves in Thailand. A lot of text coming in at 312-981-7200. 779 says, hi, all. What if the hose crimps up and over rocks? The ocean cables are not hollow to pump a pulsing air pressure 2 miles. What if a strong kid, these texts break up and then you can't tell what they're saying. What if somebody panics? This rescue has so many variables, they can't just blow and go and get all out alive. From Sandy in Woodstock, Illinois. Thank you, Sandy. Kevin is driving through Georgia and picking up our signal. We sound good in Georgia. Good. Thank you, Kevin. Thanks for being part of the show as you're driving across the country. 870 says, the underwater cables were laid by ships on large rolls. There is no human that is strong enough to drag 2.5 miles of cables. And somebody else said, think about carrying 100 yards of garden hose across your backyard. Now, this hose would have to be much thicker and much longer, and they would have to carry it while swimming. It's just not that easy. All right. You're all being very realistic about things. By the way, Roger, there's pizza yeah. here now. You're welcome to pizza.
I walked right in while you were...
Oh, you did?
You didn't even see me in
so
the dark.
So focused. Well, it is in the dark.
Yeah, I know. I put a little red light
keep the riprap out that way, Roger.
And you know what I did? I went because... I threatened to bring in my own espresso machine.
They have like an instant coffee maker.
It's an instant. It's not instant. It's real grounds in there, real coffee.
I thought I see K-cup things out there.
Well, that's the K-cup machine. That was at the old station.
Oh, it was? Okay.
Yeah. Now there's this big behemoth machine where the real coffee beans in it, and it grinds the beans for whatever you've ordered.
Mm.
And you can make a cappuccino, you can have regular decaf, regular coffee. There is a spot for espresso. So I ran back there before the 2 o'clock news and wanted to make a quick espresso and bring it back in here because it's very good. And I push the button. It says empty coffee bin, and it wouldn't make my drink.
Oh no!
So I'm thinking, why is it always me? Why is it me, Mr. Roger Homemaker, that always has to clean things out? So I open up the machine, and I start to pull parts out from the bottom, and the first thing that comes out is the drain tray, a little tray out there that catches all the overflow of people's drinks, hasn't been cleaned out since they started using that machine 2 weeks ago. There was gook in there as I poured it out. It was filled to the top. I was lucky to get it into the sink without spilling it. Then had to pull out the container, the box in the bottom, where all the spent grounds get put into. Overflowing. It spilled into the inside of the machine. I spent 15 minutes trying to wipe that thing out.
All I said was, there's pizza available in here.
Yeah, but it tastes better when you've got a double espresso.
With espresso? That sounds terrible.
No. You like pizza with espresso is awesome.
All right.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm just going to believe you on that one.
You have to.
Let me tell you real quick, as long as we're going to talk about our woe is me life.
Okay.
At home this week, I'm doing laundry. And I got some whites in the dryer. I open up the dryer. And I don't know how the whites turned out fine, except for one sock had some gunk on it. I'm looking, what the hell is this? I look inside the dryer.
Hmm.
There is gum. One of the boys left gum in their baseball pants, apparently.
Oh, no.
It got washed. We hang most of the baseball pants so they don't shrink or so that any dirt left over doesn't get baked into them.
Uh-huh.
Threw the rest of the stuff in the dryer. There must have been gum stuck on a sock. It gets heated up and gets dried all over the steel drum of the dryer.
Oh,
I mean,
lovely.
It is caked on everywhere in there. I'm looking at this like, I cannot believe this just happened.
This is
a new one. Well, I went online and I searched removing gum baked onto a stainless steel dryer or something like typed in that phrase.
Uh-huh.
And the first thing that came up was some sort of, you know, handy life hack.
Mm-hmm.
And it said, take powder detergent, which I don't have because we only use liquid.
Okay.
But I do have powder OxyClean because we use that to soak the baseball pants.
Oh, yeah.
Take that. So I took that. I used that as my substitute for laundry detergent. And it said, get a bowl of that and put some water in and make a paste out of it.
Okay.
So I did that. And then it says, take some rags and scrub it with that paste.
Hmm.
And scrub it right on there. Well, I decided instead what I would do is I would take a toothbrush. Like you get, we have lots of toothbrushes because every time I go to the dentist, so I took a toothbrush and I did that and I scrubbed the entire, I mean, I had to do the, it took me an hour.
Oh my God.
Scrubbing the stupid thing. Jeez. And then I would scrub with that and then I would get a wet rag and then I would wipe it down and try to, it took me forever to try and get the OxyClean out because it hardens up into like big chunks of OxyClean.
Yeah.
And I had to wash it all out and keep scrubbing and scrubbing. Blah. And it didn't all completely come out, but you wouldn't look in there and know it unless you really looked and you'd see just tiny little fragments here and there that are still baked into it. So it's all fine in the end and now it works and whatever, but God.
It's like one
of those things where you have your day, you got your things you got to do, and then suddenly you open up the dryer and it's full of gum.
Yeah.
And there goes the day.
Well, at least this
is what we're doing now.
At least you could find your culprit. 2 weeks ago, I did laundry, and like you, I separate out the whites, and that includes towels and hand cloths and stuff like that. And I usually have no problem. We have two washers, two dryers in the building.
Nice.
So I finish the first load, which is all the towels and everything, and I wash it, and I throw it in the dryer, and the dryer's all done. And I time it out. I walk down. I'm starting to take stuff out of the dryer. And I get to these two large bath towels. One's one of the ones I use, and the other is one that Bridget uses. And I pull them out, and as I get ready to fold them, I see these black streaks in part of each towel.
Uh-huh.
And it's crusted. The streaks are hard and crusted. But
that doesn't exist anywhere else in any of the items in the dryer than those two towels.
Huh.
Nowhere okay. else. I got socks in there. I got a couple sweatpants and
this came out of the
else.
Dryer?
Out of the dryer. They were fine out of the washer. But out of the dryer, these two towels have these black streaks in part of them. I mean, it wasn't like all over the place. It was just a few, but it was enough where you go, oh, my God, what happened?
Yeah. Did you check the dryer?
I checked the dryer. There's, you know how in the dryer there's a couple of arms that jut out, like two or three arms yeah. that keep things from...
things around? Yeah.
Yeah, right. Well, one of them broke off a long time ago, and no one ever called for the repair person to come in and fix it. And I thought maybe, oh, there might be a little oil or something yeah. that kind of got loose in there, but it's been broken for months. This would have happened long before this.
Could something have been in there from the previous laundry that just
I always
melted
look.
Onto the tire?
I always look. I sweep the floors down there. I wipe out the inside of the washers and the dryers. Of course, I'm down there at 4:30 Tuesday mornings.
Yeah.
But nothing. And then again, I did the laundry this week, Tuesday. Nothing. Hmm. No problem. I have no idea where this mystery stuff came from. So at least you got to clean yours out. I can't even find where mine's coming from or when it's going to show up again.
Well, that's going to be difficult for you. But at least it wasn't too bad. I mean, at least it wasn't too big of a mess, right?
Well, no. I mean, once I calmed Bridget down.
All right. Len, Gene, and the other caller from 708 that are on hold, you guys have to hold on a few more minutes because our special guest was able to join us by the phone. Spencer Lee is an Elvis expert, and there's some really cool Elvis stuff going on in the world right now we wanted to check in on. Good morning, Spencer. How are you this morning? Oh, hold on. Let me make sure I get you online. There you are, sir. Spencer, are you there, sir?
Yes, I am. Hi, Matt. Good to speak to you from a very sunny Liverpool.
How are things in Liverpool this morning?
Amazing, actually. We haven't had rain. It's like Tuscany. We haven't had rain for about 3 weeks now. Our lawn used to look about the worst in the road, but everybody's lawn looks like ours now. It's just, you know, there's just no water, really. I'm surprised there hasn't been a hose pipe ban.
A hose pipe ban? Does that mean a watering ban? You can't water your lawn?
That's right. Don't you have them in America?
We do. We don't call it a hose pipe here. We just say, you know, you can't water your lawn. Or you can only
right.
do it on certain days.
No, but we're okay at the moment. We can actually water our lawn. Well, but the weather is just amazing, and it's going to be it's a clear blue sky today, too.
Well, you know, it's great to talk to you, and thanks for jumping on the phone with us, Spencer. You are the author of an Elvis Presley book called Elvis Presley Caught in a Trap. Is that mm-hmm. out yet, or is that coming out?
Oh, that came out a few months ago.
That came out last year for the 40th anniversary of Elvis's passing away, right?
That's right, yes, yeah. Yeah, and it's a book that I suppose has been about 50 years in the writing because I've always wanted to do something on Elvis and have written articles on Elvis over the years, and I thought it would be really good to look at his whole life and try and work out, you know, what motivated him, or why he did certain things that he did. And in fact, that's why why the book is called Caught in a Trap. I mean, he was almost like a hamster on a wheel at times, well, you know, caught in all those silly films that he made in Los and in later years, you know, doing shows over and over in Las Vegas. He was caught in another wheel there. He got caught in something and sort of didn't move on. And a lot of it is down to Colonel Parker, of course.
Well,
I do think in the later years that Priscilla, who really, I think, understood Elvis, although obviously she divorced him in the end. But I think she would have been a brilliant manager for him, and it's a great pity that she didn't replace Colonel Parker. And since Elvis has died, she's taken hold of his career very well, I think.
When you say he was caught in this, you know, it is Colonel Parker, of course, who was making a lot of the decisions. But did Elvis cause a lot of the problems himself because of the way he spent money or the way he took care of his career, that he kind of felt he had to do certain shows to keep up his lifestyle?
Well, money is a big factor. That is the one thing that Colonel Parker and Elvis Presley both had in common. They both like making money. and so Colonel Parker was making money for him. But Colonel Parker had no artistic sensibilities at all. And so if the money was right, Elvis would do it, and he was caught in some dreadful things. And a lot of the reasons for the bad songs in the films is simply because those writers were signed to Colonel Parker's publishing company, and it was more money for Elvis and the Colonel through that. And so it was a great pity, and people like Mort Shuman and Doc Pomus and Lieber and Stoller stopped writing for Elvis. And so he still had brilliant moments and still had brilliant songs, but some of them, you know, some of the songs like A Dog's Life are just dreadful.
And I don't know Elvis's work that well, just the truly famous work, I guess, that we see all the time. But the Elvis I know and think of, Spencer, is kind of the caricature, the 1970s Elvis towards the end in the fancy suits and the studs and everything like that.
Indeed. And in fact, if you see Elvis impersonators these days, they tend to be doing the later Elvis.
Sure.
Because you could be any shape at all and be the later Elvis. And it was the initial great Elvis in 1956, where he looked absolutely amazing. He looked like nobody else on the planet, sang like nobody else on the planet, and was getting songs like nobody else on the planet. He was just remarkable then. Interestingly enough, we in Britain got him very differently from you, because in America you had the Sun label, and Elvis made these records for Sun, and then he signed to RCA beginning of 1956, and the first single was Heartbreak Hotel. We didn't get anything in Britain until Heartbreak Hotel. We didn't know anything of his past career at all. And so it was like being visited by someone from another planet. There was nowhere. I mean, although it's said that Rock Around the Clock and Heartbreak Hotel are the first big rock and roll hits, Heartbreak Hotel sounds nothing like Rock Around the Clock. It was totally unique, totally different. That amount of echo was astonishing. And I can remember being 11 years old, going to school and getting the music papers and seeing in the music papers, in the charts, this record called Heartbreak Hotel, which was an interesting title for a start, by someone called Elvis Presley. And I was thinking, gosh, there's somebody called Elvis Presley. That is a fantastic name. But I couldn't hear the record. The BBC hardly played any popular music in those days. And so it was touch and go whether you'd hear it on the BBC. I was too young to go into a record shop and sort of ask to hear the record in the booth, because I was just a kid. And one day I was off from school with a touch of flu. And I can remember this clearly, and there was a very boring program on called Housewives Choice on the radio, which played records for housewives to listen to while doing the housework. I mean, these were different times.
Yes, they were.
And at the end of this program, there was always some uplifting word from a minister. And this particular morning I was listening to it. This minister said, "I have heard the worst record I have ever heard in my life. The person who made this will burn in hell." I mean, I'm exaggerating now, but you know what I mean. He
sure.
He really hated this record, and the record he played was Heartbreak Hotel. And he only played about 40 seconds of it, and he said, "Isn't that the most awful thing that has ever been put out?" And I heard these 40 seconds. Well, Elvis cured the sick, because I got straight out of my sick bed when and bought it. It was just a remarkable record, and I've loved Elvis Presley ever since.
Well, it's funny, Spencer, to talk to you from Liverpool, yet you're an Elvis expert. That seems very odd to us Americans, right?
Well, I've written quite a number of books on the Beatles. I mean, I've written quite a lot of books about popular music, because that's what I really love. Well, the Beatles were great Elvis fans, of course, and did a few of his songs. But and I've interviewed so many people for BBC Radio Merseyside. In fact, I have actually interviewed, I'm not boasting here, it's just fact, I've interviewed more people about the Beatles than anybody else in the world.
Really?
Whether I've interviewed them well or not is another matter, but I just have, because I've been doing my shows for so long on Radio Merseyside. So I've got this huge bank of interviews, and also when people came into Liverpool, or when I interviewed celebrities and things, I also asked them about Elvis and asked them about the Beatles. So I got all these quotes about Elvis over the years. And I'd met people who'd worked with him, like Glenn D. Harden and James Burton. So I got so many quotes about Elvis, and I thought, well, this will give me something unique for the book. So many people talking about Elvis. I'm going to write the Elvis story and put these quotes in and see how it all comes together and what it looks like, and try and get some sort of motivation for Elvis's life. And I had a great deal of fun writing it, because when Elvis went into the services, for example, in 1958, if there'd been a war on at the time, I'm sure that Colonel Parker wouldn't have allowed it. But he saw that it was great PR for Elvis to go into the army. But when you look at what his life was like in the army, he had a wonderful life there. I mean, it wasn't like any other soldier. I mean, he could go home for his dinner. He went home and slept at home, at his home in Germany, it was then, during the night. So he wasn't on the camp like a regular soldier. And obviously, the regular soldiers thought this was a bit odd. But, I mean, he was Elvis Presley, and that's what happened.
It's amazing. It really is amazing. We reached out to you, Spencer. We're speaking with Spencer Lee. He is the author of Elvis Presley Caught in a Trap. You can find it online. Reason we reached out to you and found you was because we needed an expert, because there was a story here that, you know, there's all sorts of crazy and interesting Elvis memorabilia out there. But yeah, one of his private jets is up for sale. It's up for auction. It was bought just a year ago, and now it's up for auction again. But it's been parked in Roswell, New Mexico for, they say, over four decades. It's a 1962 Lockheed Jetstar. And the interesting thing is they say the interior has not been altered since Elvis Presley last owned it. Now, the pictures from the outside don't look that great. It's been sitting outside for four decades. I believe it doesn't even have its engine anymore. But they say the inside is still how Elvis had it. What is the craziest, most interesting pieces of Elvis memorabilia that are out there these days?
Well, one of them must be that. I mean, it's not actually been confirmed that Elvis actually designed the upholstery in it, but it's very close to the sort of things that Elvis liked, and, you know, the sort of things that he had in the jungle room, bright colours like red in there. So I can see that, yes, I mean, Elvis was behind that. The plane doesn't have an engine, so I'm not sure how you're going to get it to wherever you're going to take it to, and what you're going to do with it when you get it. You know, are they going to display it or what have you?
Yeah.
So there are problems with that. It is an extraordinary piece of memorabilia, yes. I mean, it's interesting that Elvis actually owned three planes, because I was reading a book on Richard Burton the other day, and he's flying somewhere, and he borrowed Frank Sinatra's plane. So a lot of these people, I think, had planes and loaned them out to other artists. Ricky Nelson, in fact, died in a plane that had been owned by Jerry Lee Lewis. Mm. So, you know, it's probably an interesting subject in itself, who actually owns the planes and what happened to them. But when you're talking about odd memorabilia, I can remember, I mean, I'm going to sound lunatic when I say this, but I can remember being in London once, and there was, across the water on the South Bank, there was an Elvis display which included Elvis's wart. He'd had a wart removed, and someone in the medical, one of the medics had taken this wart, and obviously it had been passed on, and it was there on display. And I thought, well, I must go and see this. So I remember walking across the Thames and thinking, I am absolutely nuts, walking an extra mile or so just to go and see Elvis's wart. Admittedly, there were some of his fingernails there too. It is extraordinary what there is, actually.
Was there an admission fee to go see Elvis's warts and fingernails?
Oh, yes, yeah, it was an exhibition. It had other things with it, but they were the sort of selling features of this exhibition.
Well, now we know somebody has some Elvis DNA out there, and maybe they will clone him someday.
Well, exactly. This is it. If you've got something like that, maybe, you know, in 20, 30, 40 years' time, you could actually do something with that. I don't know. I mean, technology is just advancing at such a fast rate these days.
That is true.
But, I mean, there are so many odd thoughts about Elvis. I mean, if you look at the reviews of my book on Amazon, you will see that there are people who give the book one star because they say Elvis is still alive, and I haven't taken that into account.
Well,
and there's nothing you can do about that these days.
That'll be the sequel. Elvis Presley Caught in a Trap is the book. It came out a year ago. We had the 40th anniversary a year ago, so we're coming up on 41 years since Elvis passed away. Spencer Lee is the author. We're running out of time here, Spencer, but I'd love to have you back another time.
Yeah, any time. I'm working on a book on Buddy Holly at the moment for the 60th anniversary.
Excellent, excellent. We will check in again soon. Thank you so much for jumping on the phone. Spencer Lee, the book Elvis Presley Caught in a Trap. Quick break, and then the news next on 720 WGN. Matt Bubala with you here on 720 WGN. Spencer Lee was our Elvis guest. His book, Elvis Caught in a Trap, available on Amazon.com right now. He mentioned he was writing a book now about Buddy Holly, so we'll check in with him again down the road. The idea of finding your passion, I think we always say, you know, if you do what you love, you'll never work a day in your life. And we encourage people to find their passion, to, you know, do what you really love. But is the way we say that possibly putting them, is there a way that that's not the best advice in the world? Do we need to be a little more realistic about our passions? Article I saw a couple of weeks ago said, your passion isn't out there waiting to be discovered. It's not a mysterious force that will, when found, remove all obstacles from your path. In fact, psychologists argue in a new study that the pithy mantra, find your passion, may be a dangerous distraction. One of the people that was part of this study that they're writing about in Quartz is Paul O'Keefe. He is an assistant professor of social sciences at the Yale NUS College. He joins us on the phone right now. Hey, Paul, good morning. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. How about you? Thanks.
Thank you very much for jumping on the phone with us. Explaining, this is Yale National University of Singapore?
Yes. It is a collaborative institution between the National University of Singapore and Yale University.
Very cool. And how long have you been in Singapore?
I've been a professor there for about 4 years now.
And how was the summit, I have to ask? Was that crazy time?
Luckily, I was in the United States for that one.
Are you serious? Is that luckily? Or would
yeah,
that
I
been,
was.
I would think it would have been interesting to be there.
I happened to be at a conference in California.
Huh. So you missed it all.
Well, I missed it.
Well, let me ask you a little bit about this, because I want to make sure I'm saying this right. You know, generally we tell people do what you love or find your passion and all of these things. But in this study, you guys say that passion can't just be me sitting back. Well, what are you passionate? Well, you know, I really love space, so maybe I should be an astronaut. That's not enough for us to pursue. We have to, you guys argue, you have to kind of feed your passion. You have to be willing to engage and understand that passion doesn't mean just what you love because it's easy.
So as you were saying, some of the mantras that we hear suggest that we have this passion. So if we tell people to, you know, to find their passion, what that could mean for some people is that it's inherent within them and it merely needs to be revealed, right? It's in us. We were maybe born with them, mm-hmm. and they're preformed and ready to go. And if people believe that, so we call this a fixed theory of interest. And if people believe this, then, well, if you've already established some pretty, you know, strong interests, that might stop you from exploring other areas. In fact, it may not even make sense to explore other areas if you think that your interests are fixed and that you've already found them.
So if you think that you were born to do this, so that's what they were born to do, then you will just, you might not explore other areas that maybe you would have loved more and been more engaged in and better at?
Well, so in this research, we really kind of divorce it from abilities. That's a little bit of a different topic. So we're just talking about people's interests. What's, you know, are they going to develop other interests or not? And people with what we call a growth theory believe that interests might start as like a spark, a curiosity, but that it's something that grows over time, right? With involvement, with commitment, maybe discipline even, but it's something that develops. And so even for those people, if they have really strong interests, that doesn't preclude them for exploring other areas and developing new interests.
Okay. And are those just the two theories, either fixed or growth?
So, yeah. So, this is stemming from a long history of research. Well, it goes back several decades now that examines how people, you know, think about multiple attributes about themselves, whether it be their personality or their intelligence, their shyness, and whether these things are fixed and relatively stable or if they're subject to change and improvement. So these are two kind of fundamental ways people think about their characteristics, their attributes. And we've taken this way of thinking and applied it to how people think about the nature of interests and how they operate and what, you know, what they can expect from their interests when they find them.
When you realize that somebody is a fixed theory person versus a growth theory person, do we want to change that? Do we all want to be growth theory persons? Is there any benefit to being a fixed theory person?
Well, there could be. You know, I'm an educator. I teach many undergraduates. So, and, you know, part of the challenge and the amazingness of college is that we, and one of the goals of college is to get students engaged in many different topics. We don't necessarily, at least in the United States, we don't want to educate students in a silo. We want them to understand multiple topics. That's what a liberal arts education is all about. We want them to see connections among these topics and to see how integrated the world is. So from that perspective, what our research suggests is that a growth mindset is going to help our students do that. We haven't, you know, fully, this is merely kind of our first step in examining these beliefs about interest. So we don't know. There could be benefits to having a fixed theory. Maybe for some fields that might be more, that rely maybe more on one discipline rather than multiple disciplines, maybe there is some sort of benefit. But so far, we don't necessarily see that. We see that people with this growth mindset are not only engaging and as interested in their own interests, you know, their pre-existing interests, as fixed theorists are, but they're also developing new interests. They're open to new interests. And when those interests become difficult, they don't give up on them.
I imagine this is a very important study when it comes to colleges, too, because we're all in the situation where the expense of college has grown by so much here in the United States that kids these days who are leaving high school are facing more and more pressure to know why they're going to college. I went to a liberal arts college. I had no idea what I wanted to do. At 46, I feel like I'm still figuring it out. But kids these days don't get that luxury of going somewhere, walking away with $100,000 in debt and not exactly knowing why they went there in the first place, other than it was great and I made a lot of good friends and I really loved it. Sure. Knowing how to pursue passions and what that means, is there a way that we can then correlate this to our kids and how we use this information to try to not helicopter them to death, but help them figure out how to develop their passions and maybe not shy away from certain things?
Well, yeah, sure. So one of the very important things that we found in this paper is that, let me go back just a little bit and you know, talk about theoretically how this implication is grounded, that if you believe that interests are fixed, then, as I said before, you believe that they're preformed, and then they, you know, when they're found, they're revealed 100%. And with that, our research finds that people think that pursuing those interests and passions will come easily, right? People with a growth theory have different anticipation, different expectations for what their motivation will be. They anticipate difficulties because that is part of the developmental process. So in some of our, the last study in that paper, what we found is that after getting students really interested in a topic, in our case, we got them really interested in astrophysics with a fun animated cartoon that discusses black holes and Stephen Hawking's theories. It was very accessible to people. So everyone was really interested in it. And then we followed it up with something more difficult. We had them read an actual scientific article on black holes. So this time it was more complicated, a little bit more abstract. There were some equations. So it was more difficult to understand. And what we found, although both fixed and growth theorists, they dropped their interest a little bit when it became more difficult. For growth theorists, they maintained their interest. They expected difficulty. They expected that pursuing a new interest is going to be difficult at some times. It's a developmental process. For fixed theorists, they actually went from being fascinated to about 5 to 7 minutes later being uninterested, reporting that they were uninterested in the topic when it got difficult. So when we are encouraging students or children, employees, to find their passion, or we might be suggesting to them that, you know, your interests are going to be 100%, and if things get difficult, that must mean it's not your true interest after all, right? And with a growth theory, we're telling them, if we tell them that their interests and passions are developed, we're suggesting to them it's a process, and because it's a process, sometimes it's going to be difficult, and that's okay.
Yeah, it's very interesting, and that all makes perfect sense. I wonder if there's an area, and I don't want to sound like I'm advocating being a quitter or anything like that, because I don't mean to sound like that, but you know, you wonder if there's something to knowing your limits or knowing what your passions, how far your passions will really go. If I, you know, if you showed me a medical video in school and like, man, I want to be a doctor. Yeah, I'm going to do this. And then the first time I took a class, it was really difficult. I said, yeah, but I'm going to stick through it. And then I'm getting C's and D's and I'm, but I know if I, and then I just never get there, we might look back and go, would you have been better off realizing at the time, maybe that wasn't for you because you just don't have that area to do all that. Where does that fit in that thinking?
Well, you know, I it's certainly possible that that could happen, and it does happen in the real world. You just have to watch American Idol to to realize that that happens. But so far in our research and past research on growth mindsets, we just don't see this unrealistic behavior. You know, we're not seeing people who say that they're, they can develop an interest in anything, and they're going to go for it 100%. It's not really that. It's just this idea. It's these mindsets. The reason that they can be so powerful is because these are beliefs, just like any other beliefs. And our beliefs are the lenses through which we see the world, right? So we our interpretations of the world are being colored by our beliefs about the nature of interest. And it's just, for a growth theorist, it's just leading them to be more open to new interests, our research shows, and also to expect difficulties when they arise. It doesn't, theoretically, it doesn't say anything about pursuing a relentless pursuit of interests and passions when things aren't going well. It's assumed that there's this realistic interpretation that's going on here that, you know, if things aren't happening, if I'm not getting all those singing gigs or acting gigs that I hope to get, you know, maybe this is something I can be passionate about, I can love, but, you know, there might be other things that might be wiser for me to pursue. So, yeah, we don't see any of these really deleterious outcomes associated with a growth theory. But again, there's a lot more to investigate.
There's an interesting piece at the end of the article that says, those who search for their one true love have unrealistic expectations and can end up on an endless and empty quest. Meanwhile, those who believe that love is a project and a process will exercise more patience when their partner falls short of expectations and can ultimately experience moments of true love. Extend the logic to interest, and the chances of actually being passionately fascinated increases. I think that's interesting to relate it to love, because there really are kind of, I find, two types of people in the world. The ones that think there is this one true love out there for you. I guess it's sort of the same thing as thinking there's this one true passion within you. You just got to find it, and then you'll have success. And maybe the more realistic person says, there's many people you could fall in love with, but it doesn't mean it's going to happen, and then just everything's easy. It's still going to be a lot of work and a lot of education and patience and all these things if that's really going to work out in the end.
Absolutely. And you know what? That's one of the ways that we talk about it in the introduction to our paper, because it really is a great analog. It's a way to think about our interests and passions in a way that maybe is more tangible for a lot of people, because these ideas, just like these ideas about romantic ideas about passions and interests, people have very romantic and unfortunately unrealistic ideas about romantic relationships and what that we should be finding that one, and that when we do find that one, everything's going to work out perfectly. And that's not really just not the, a realistic way to pursue our goals.
Yeah, it's not. How do you decide? What would your general theory be on your passions and chasing your passions? I know that what we're learning is that, you know, don't just get dissuaded by something because it gets difficult. Anything in life, I guess we go with the old theory that anything worth doing is worth doing well, and it's going to be difficult. Nothing is easy. So don't be shaken if your passion suddenly seems a little more difficult. Keep with it and see where it takes you. And maybe ultimately it will not be the thing for you, but don't just give up because it wasn't easy. Just because it's your passion doesn't mean it should be easy. Go ahead.
The first thing that comes to my mind are people who learning how to learn an instrument. You know, I'm a musician. I remember starting myself, and it's just so incredibly difficult. I mean, almost no matter what instrument you pick up, your hand-eye coordination is just totally different. You're not accustomed to it. You got to get over this hump. And these things are really important, because if you believe that, you know, your true interest, your true passion is playing this instrument, and it doesn't come super easy really quickly, then it's basically violating your expectation. It's saying that, oh, this isn't my true interest or passion after all. I have to keep looking. If you have a growth theory, it's simply getting you to interpret that exact same situation a little differently. It's saying that I expect it to be a journey, a process, a developmental process. And it's okay that it's difficult now. That doesn't mean that this isn't my interest. This is all part of it, right? So these are just very subtle differences in how we interpret things and how they can really have quite different outcomes.
It's interesting that you mentioned, you know, taking up an instrument, because I think that's such a common thing for American kids, at least back in the day when the schools more often had bands, that you get to fourth or fifth grade and we're going to play instruments. Who wants to play? And then you all come home with something. Your parents go, oh, my God, no. And then you're, you know, playing the clarinet for 3 weeks like I did, and then going, oh, God, this is terrible. I can't do this. And then you quit. And I wonder if in your study, if you looked at people who... If you did a big study of people who picked up an instrument and stuck with it versus those of us that quit very quickly, how we would fit in versus growth and fixed theory in that way. I wonder if the people who stuck with it, because it was difficult probably for 85% of the people, but if they still learned to play that instrument and played it for a few years, I wonder if that helped them develop the idea that, yeah, sometimes in life things are difficult doesn't mean you quit.
I have no doubt that a growth mindset would be, at least in part, a predictor of sticking with the instrument. We haven't looked at it, but it would be that domain in particular, music and learning musical instruments, but it would be a really fantastic area to look at. In our case, for our research, we used an analog for that. And I say that only in terms of difficulty, in that people can get really excited about astrophysics, right? You look at kids who see the latest Star Wars movie,
yeah,
and then they just get fascinated by space, right? Just like I was when I saw Return of the Jedi in the theater when I was a kid, you know? But it's that might spark an interest. But when they finally decide to take that interest a little step further, and they go take a college course in astrophysics, you know, fixed theorists might be really phased by the difficulty. But the growth theorists are going to be okay with it. They're going to anticipate it. They know it's there, and it's okay. And so we think that we haven't done, we've done a few longer-term studies that haven't been published yet, but there is evidence to say, to suggest that growth theorists are sticking with these classes and they're actually learning more. So this is really important. It doesn't just stop at interest.
Well, do we develop growth theorists, or are they born that way? Is it a product of how we're raising our kids?
It's a total product of how we socialize children, the messages we give employees, the messages teachers give their students. And a lot of times they're really well-intended things that are said. You open the show by saying, do what you love and you'll never work a day in your life. You know, we've heard that our whole lives. And it's really well-intended, right? It's meant to get people to really search for something that they love. But what it also suggests is that if you encounter difficulty, then abandon it. Go look for something else that comes totally easily to you, that you love and comes totally easily to you. That's really, really terrible advice to be giving people. But these types of nuances, these subtleties in what we say to these people, they get, like, they're understood. You know, kids are smart. Students are smart. They hear these things and they interpret them in these ways. So I think we need to be more careful about what we're saying to people. We need to be focusing on development, suggesting that these things take time. You know, these things, you have to get involved. You have to, it involves some commitment. You know, the more you stick with something, the more you learn about it, the more you get excited about it, the more personally valuable it becomes. So suggesting to students, employees, children, that interests are developed, I think goes a long way. So if we can change the conversation, change the language around how we encourage these people, I think that'll go a long way. So we're not born with these. These are messages we get that we're socialized with.
And we're not saying don't pursue your passion. We're saying be more open to the different passions you might have and be more exploratory with them. Don't quit something that you maybe thought you loved just because it seemed a little more difficult than you thought it would be.
Yeah, and one of the big implications here is it's not that you're jumping from one interest to another. That's farthest from the point that we're trying to make. You could be someone with a deep, abiding passion for painting. But why can't you also develop interests in mathematics, the sciences, this and that? You know, we wouldn't have, you know, things like Apple or Facebook if the people behind them didn't have interest in both humanities and the sciences. These are, you know, examples of how those things could be merged, right? So if you can have strong interests but also develop other interests and see how they're connected, that's a really great thing. And again, as an educator, that's really what I want my students to do, right?
Yeah, absolutely. We're speaking with Paul O'Keefe. He's an assistant professor of social sciences at the Yale National University of Singapore College. Can you hang on for just a minute? I have to take a quick break for the news, but I do want to ask you a couple more questions about our kids going into college and their passions. Can you hang on for just a couple?
Absolutely.
All right. Paul O'Keefe will join us right after the news. Let's take a quick break. Then we'll do the headlines with Roger and then get back at it with Paul and your questions or comments as well if you need. 312-981-7200. Matt Bubala here with you on 720 WGN. Bubala here with you, 720 WGN. Good morning, everybody. Thanks for hanging out overnights with us. We're here until 5 a.m. when Orion's here with the morning show. We're chatting with Paul O'Keefe. He's an assistant professor of social sciences at the Yale National University of Singapore. And Paul, how many years have you been living over in Singapore now? Oh, hold on.
Been here for 4 years.
4 years, man. And what is life like in Singapore? How different is it than our everyday American life?
Oh, it's different in, you know, some fundamental ways, but I would say that being here, it's a very smooth transition. It's a very cosmopolitan city, a very international city, very diverse. You know, there are some, you know, some cultural differences here and there, but it's a very easy city to live in, very expensive.
And in general, is it pretty friendly to Americans? Is with their current state of the world, is it friendly to Americans to be over there?
Absolutely, yeah. Very. It's a country that embraces diversity. Lots of huge expat community here. No complaints.
Excellent. So I still wanted to ask you one thing. Is we were talking a little bit about kids going into college these days, and so I went to a liberal arts college, and I went into school not knowing what I wanted to do. But with the cost of school these days, you know, that is a concern. And I know a lot of kids in our neighborhood that are doing a couple years of junior college while they figure out what they want to go to school for. Is that, you know, that's fundamental difference, that school costs so much these days that there's more pressure on kids to know what they want to do and go to school for a specific reason. Is that good, or do you think that that's possibly going to be detrimental, that kids need to go in a little more with an open mind and figure out what life has to offer and what their true passions really are? Asking a senior in high school to know exactly why they want to go to a college and what they're planning to do there, is that too much pressure to put on kids?
Well, it's interesting you asked that, given that we were just talking about cultural differences. Because, you know, the educational system in Singapore is quite different than the United States. Around the time of high school, they're starting to specialize. So by the time they even get into college, at least most of the colleges here, they started with a specialty. So, and this isn't just Singapore, that this, you know, this type of education exists in many parts of the world, where you take on a focus very early. Quite different from the American perspective, which embraces the liberal arts. Even at our big R1 schools, we have a liberal arts program such that, you know, we're getting students to experience and delve into many topics, understand those topics, and then later specialize. You know, that's where the major comes in. It's not a problem to, you know, have kids explore. I think it's a very good thing. I think it's, you know, even within in the Singaporean system where they're specializing very early, as long as they're perhaps seeking out opportunities, and hopefully there's some support for opportunities to explore other areas, and that they're doing it with the mindset that more interest can be developed. It's not just this one. If I'm decided I'm going to be an engineer, that there are other really cool things that complement my interest in engineering, right? Why can't an engineer, so an engineering student, also think, you know, how can I take what we know in the social sciences or cultural anthropology and understand how I can bring engineering innovations to maybe remote parts of the world who need potable water, this and that. So, I think providing opportunities to our students is a really, really great thing for them to explore different topics. But at the end of the day, what our research is showing is you can, you know, give all the opportunities in the world to a fixed theorist, but they may not be taking those opportunities seriously. They may not be developing interest because they just don't think that is the way interests work. So for me, what should be encouraged there, and my co-authors would agree that we need to be encouraging students to think of interests as developed. So whatever school system they go into, a growth mindset has the potential to help them.
And we can you would say that we could change, if we're a fixed theorist, we can work on that. We could become more of a growth theorist. Is there a point in life where we're kind of, well, he's a fixed theorist, we're not going to change him now?
No, I I'm a very optimistic person.
You're a growth theorist.
People, exactly. Their beliefs, right? Some beliefs can be very, very, they can stick. They can be very sticky. You know, people's political beliefs, their religious beliefs. We all know that some people are very rigid, and there's a whole host of research showing how difficult it can be to change people's beliefs, but it can be done, right? All of us have had some fairly fundamental things, that ways that we used to think, and now we think differently. So even as adults, I'm very optimistic that we can change this way of thinking. But I think what you're suggesting is that it might be a little easier with younger people, and I think that's probably right, because they're more suggestible, they're more open to, they don't understand, at least in their head, they don't think that they totally understand the world yet, so they're more open to different ways of thinking, right?
Yeah, I would imagine they are, and I imagine for those of us that are older and more kind of, you know, think of ourselves as fixed in our ways, and some of those ways which we acknowledge we're not really thrilled with ourselves about, right? That, well, I'm pretty pessimistic about this, or I'm not like this, I wish I wasn't like this. I wonder how much we really can change ourselves later in life. Is it a matter of realization and then working on it?
Yeah, absolutely. And it has to be very authentic, too. You can't just have someone come up and say, you need to change your mindset. If someone tells me I'm a highly reactive person, if someone tells me I need to change something, I'm not going to have that. And a lot of people are like that, right? So, sure. So that's why I'm stressing like the language that we use. Instead of going around telling people that, you know, this is a bad mindset, you need to change that. It's if the language changes in our culture, and it'll take on a different meaning of what interests are, what you should expect from your interests and passions. And I think that part of that, you know, intertwining it within how people are socialized is going to make a big difference. You know, older people, obviously, there's a lot more stress in their lives. They have bigger things to worry about, like paying bills and feeding their families, than to worry about, you know, some of these other things that might be more of a luxury, like pursuing a passion. So that's understandable. That's certainly one explanation for why it might be more difficult to change your mind as you're older. But when you're, you know, younger, at least you have more latitude there. And so to the extent to which we can change the language in schools and so forth, that'll be really good.
Paul, is it possible for us to be both a fixed and a growth theorist? Like in some aspects of my life, I'm really stuck in my certain way and I only see things one way, but in other things, or are we generally, you're either one or the other, and that kind of encompasses everything?
Absolutely. So these beliefs, there's considerable research on this. These fixed and growth beliefs can be domain to domain. So some people might have a fixed theory about their shyness. They think that they're a shy person, and that's never going to change, right? But they could also have a growth theory about their intelligence, right? That even if they're struggling in their math class, they believe that their intelligence is improvable, and then they can learn and work hard to continue learning. And even within, you know, domains for theories of intelligence, people's beliefs about the malleability of intelligence, you might have a fixed theory in the humanities, but a growth theory in math. So these are definitely domain specific, and each one is going to be crafted in part by one's own experience and their interpretation of all those experiences that they have.
Mm. It's fascinating study. I really appreciate you jumping on the phone. Paul O'Keefe is an assistant professor of social sciences at the Yale National University of Singapore College. And I hope we can talk again. It's really been fun being enlightened by you.
Likewise. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you. We'll talk again. Paul O'Keefe in Singapore. We had good overseas guests today. I really enjoyed, the idea that you can change how you think, I think, is fascinating, especially in today's world where so many of us draw hard lines in the sand about what we think about certain things and we're all at each other's throats about it. We really do need to do more of thinking more broadly about the world and about the people around us and about the possibilities within and what the possibilities for us are as well. And I don't think we're ever too late to do that. 312-981-7200. Matt Bubala with you, 720 WGN. 312-981-7200. Matt Bubala here with you on 720 WGN. That's Kesha and Pitbull. And just as saying, Pitbull was at Ribfest. Here, talk into the microphone. When did Pitbull perform at Ribfest? Yeah, use the right microphone.
I forgot I moved it.
New studio.
I believe he was there just the other day, like the 4th or the 5th.
Now, I know that Ribfest, and I've never been to Ribfest, but I know it is one of the biggest things in the state of Illinois. It's a huge festival, right? Is that, when you hear Pitbull at Ribfest, are you like, Pitbull's doing Ribfest? Are you a little surprised that Pitbull was at Ribfest?
I was. I thought it was kind of a odd combination. Yeah. On Thursday, July 5th, that's when he performed at Ribfest.
Pitbull seems bigger than Ribfest, right? Now, maybe Ribfest has gotten that big and I didn't realize it.
Maybe.
But I could see Pitbull at Summerfest in Milwaukee. I could see Pitbull maybe even in Grant Park or Taste of Chicago. But in Naperville at Ribfest?
Yeah, I actually saw some of my old friends like posting it on Facebook and stuff, like videos.
Like, I expect Rick Springfield to be at Ribfest. I think he was. You know, I don't expect Pitbull to be at Ribfest. All right, jumping back into the boys stuck in the caves in Thailand. This is another story from CNN about the dangers of this. And so the story is about, you know, the kids that are in the classrooms praying for the return of their friends. It says, quote, "I was very worried about what would happen to them. The caves are a dark and scary place. I wouldn't dare to ever go in there," says 14-year-old Kachoki Konaka, whose friend is among the 12 young teammates and their coach who inexplicably defied local warnings and wandered deep into the cave. And they have some pictures of the mountainous region and show little diagrams of where the entrance was, where the caves are, how they ended up there. Both of these boys they interviewed play on the same football team as the missing boys and may have been with them if they hadn't skipped practice on the day of the trip. Now even the idea of playing football makes the boys feel sad. In the immediate days that followed the boys' disappearance, life in the small, close-knit school of several hundred became almost unbearable. And it talks about how they rejoiced when they found out that the boys had been found. For 9 days, the missing group had no food, no water, no way of communicating with the outside world. As the days dragged on, the seriousness of their classmates' situation weighed heavily on the minds of the students. The sense of euphoria generated by news of the boys' discovery was especially acute at the nearby Ban Wong Hapan School, a small, neat collection of buildings not far from the town's main market area. In grainy video shot by the first rescue team to make contact with the boys, a British diver can be heard asking, "How many of you are there?" In English, one boy answers, 13. At the front of the school, a giant mural wishing safe recovery has been installed underneath the images of the missing children. It's not unusual for families to cross the border to search for work or go to school, as they talk about some of the boys in this other area, and they're right near the border of Myanmar. The Psirin has traveled to the entrance of the caves every night since the boy's disappearance, hoping for news of his star pupil. From this event, we can see all Thai people care for each other, no matter where we're from, yada, yada, yada. They all talk about how they've come together in this time. But the story mentions, Roger, that, you know, some of the kids are like, "I would never go in there. We know not to go in there. We're told not to go in there," especially during monsoon season. We don't know what the heck they were doing going in there. And the fact that they went so deep in there.
How many, 2.5 miles, you said, into the...
About 2.5 miles back there, yeah.
I, well, why would you go 2.5 miles through a very treacherous? It didn't take them like a quick time. It took them a while to get through there because it was extremely treacherous. Like we talked about before, it wasn't a straight path. So if they knew it was going to take them that long, why would they go that far in knowing they had to eventually get back out, especially during monsoon season? So I just don't understand why they went so far.
I'm still trying to figure out how we can get more oxygen in there.
I know. And you're a can-do guy.
Everybody talks about the whole we're going to drag a cord through there or a hose. If divers have been able to get through there, I know it's a tight fit, so it's not like they can carry a ton of equipment. But there has to be, I imagine, equipment that's out there that takes water and makes oxygen or something like that, right?
It's not. You don't think we could barely swim. Have you read some of the accounts of the divers that they barely could get through themselves?
I know, but there's got to be some sort of small equipment like dehumidifier type thing, something that could be.
Look, I'm a can-do kind of guy, but.
Roger, we got Apollo 13 back. They were having fires on board that thing.
I understand.
They had like duct tape and lint, and they fashioned something out of it.
I understand they did. But this is a different kind of situation with its own issues. And I don't think that a readily available, hey, here's some hoses. They're thick enough to pump some air through it. Let's get some pumps. And let's go ahead and pump air in. I just don't think it's that easy, because if it was, it would have been done already. I think they have some major issues to deal with there, and they are trying to think of the easiest, the safest, and the quickest way to get those kids out of there. If they come to the conclusion, I think, that they can't get the kids out until, when did you say, October, the end of monsoon season?
Yeah. It's a while away.
Right. Then I think the focus turns to trying to keep them alive in that space. Who knows? I mean, if monsoon season is as bad as it could be, that whole chamber they're in could become flooded.
Well, I think we're already at the point of they're just trying to keep them alive, because one of the other stories was telling us it's down to like 15% oxygen.
Exactly.
So they're in danger of, you know, hyperexia.
Definitely. And that's why I think they're trying to, as quickly as possible, get them trained, try to get enough equipment in there so that they can try to get them out.
Our best answer is to train these kids to dive.
Yes.
We have divers, trained SEALs. A SEAL died.
Yes.
Coming in and out of there. And the professional divers are taking 5 hours to get through.
Mm-hmm.
So we think we're going to train these 12-year-olds on how to dive, mm-hmm. and they're going to swim out.
Well, that's what the people in charge are thinking. That's what it sounds like from the reports.
There's a line in the movie Fargo. No, mm-hmm. I'm sorry, not Fargo. What, Argo.
Oh, when they're trying to get them out of
Iran.
Iran.
So when the Iranian embassy was sieged and, 435 Americans were captured,
mm-hmm.
like six or so got out and escaped to the Canadian embassy.
Mm-hmm.
But they were stuck there forever. And then we come up with this plan to get them out.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they present the plan, which ended up being...
They were part of a film crew or something?
An American sneaks in. And he's going to pick them up. These are Canadians with him. And we're all part of a film crew. We want to do a film here in Iran. It's mm-hmm. kind of a Star Wars knockoff type thing. And so the U.S. government's ideas were, well, we will we'll pretend they were teachers. We'll pretend they were missionaries. We'll do all these things. And, and they were all like, none of that's going to work. So here's the idea. They're a film crew. We're scouting. We're location directors, blah, 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 blah. And the government guy that brings us to says, sounds like a really bad idea. And he says, sir, this is the best bad idea we have. Training these kids to swim is them going, there's nothing but bad ideas. This is the best bad idea we have.
There is no good idea, because there's nothing that they can do quickly enough, efficiently enough, to get those kids out quickly enough.
If the idea is training them to dive, I think we've got time for better ideas.
And that doesn't happen overnight. Who's saying they're not working on that?
Well, I don't know.
Well,
that's
because it's not being reported. Because they're just reporting on what's happening at the scene. I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I'm worried about this. This is ridiculous. I'm upset that they went in there. Now that the die has been cast, let's try to come up with what we can to get them out of there ASAP.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's...
I agree. We got to try something better than what we're doing, though.
Yeah, well, but what's better? Are you there? You need to be there.
I'm giving you ideas.
I know.
Call somebody. Tell
I know,
them.
But you're not there to talk to these people to find out why 99.9% of the ideas we're thinking of here back in our cushy little radio station probably are not going to work.
312-981-7200 is the phone number. Our friend Mark Shipper is over in San Fermin at the festival. The Running of the Bulls is coming up. We're going to check in with him after the news. It is 4 o'clock in the morning. Look at that. It's 4 o'clock in the morning. The Steve Cochran Show.
Go ahead.
Listen. The Steve Cochran Show celebrates the most valuable person on the planet. Weekday mornings at 7:20. I'll tell you who it's not.
You know what? It's the closest you've been in a long time.
On 720 WGN Chicago. Hey, smart speaker users, just say play WGN Radio on TuneIn. News now. Here's Roger Badish. Morning, everybody. Matt Bubala with you here for one more hour on 720 WGN. 312-981-7200 is the number. 815 says it was explained earlier today that the teaching of the boys to dive gives them something else to think about and gives them a better feeling that they're doing something to help with the rescue and gives them hope, whether or not they ever use the diving to actually evacuate. All right, I will buy into that, but I will say this. If I'm in that cave, I don't swim very well. I don't swim very well personally. And if they're trying to say, okay, here's what we're going to do. You're going to learn how to dive. I'm going to be like, all right, so I'm just dead then is what you're telling me, because this is never going to work. And instead of it being filled with hope, I'd be like, oh, God.
Can you float?
Not well, no.
Okay.
I can't float down all this way and then back up.
All right. Well, but you're going to be with a diver. Two, you're going to have a full head helmet on, pumping oxygen in and out. And I'm sure they have some sort of guide rope or chain, or something that has already been strung through.
If they had a guide rope or chain, they would have an oxygen hose. You told me that couldn't be done.
A rope is easy. An oxygen hose is not.
How is a rope easy and a hose is not?
First of all, you don't have to pump anything through a rope.
So?
A hose you do. It has to be large enough to be able to take the
oxygen
and pump it through 2.5 miles.
It doesn't have to be any thicker than a garden hose,
you
right?
It has to be bigger. And you have to have pumps along the way. You can't pump it 2.5 miles. You know what kind of... Here's what it's going to sound like at the other end. You're not going to get any air out of it.
Roger.
Are you a technician?
No, clearly not, but I don't think you are either. If we have a hose,
yes,
and it's pumping air,
yes,
and at one end it's pumping air through this hose, you're telling me it will not come out the other end 2.5 miles later?
It will not.
Why?
You do not have a pump strong enough to pump something 2.5 miles. All right. What else can you pump? All right, push oil. Let's say you're pushing oil.
Oil is heavy. Air is not.
It's liquid. It's liquid.
Air is air.
A pump can only push something so far. It then needs another pump to pick it up and move it along again. Do you not?
Wouldn't the force of continually pumping the air force out the other end?
No.
Why?
You need pumps along the way. Yes. The same thing happened with the Morse code. Why do you think they had to have stations along the way at certain intervals? Because the electrical signal could only travel so far under the power that it was pushed by the electronic key. There is just so far that a portion of air can be pushed by a pump even if it was as huge as a house, you still would not be able to push enough air to make it worthwhile for 2.5 miles.
I don't buy that.
I want an engineer to call up.
708 says, if you two were in a cave together, you'd kill each other.
Don't make me come in there.
Roger, quit breathing so heavy. Save some oxygen for me, for goodness sakes.
If I was one of the kids, I'd run up to the end of the hose and hog the whole thing to myself.
You're sucking on it. Everybody's like, well, I don't want that oxygen. Rather, Roger put his mouth on it.
You see me starting to blow up like a balloon?
I'm taking it all. You're like Veruca Salt suddenly, yes, in the cave.
Yes.
Gene has called in. It's 312-981-7200. Hello, Gene. Good morning. How are you?
Hi. Okay. You know, this whole thing is a good reminder of the things that expectations that different cultures have about rearing children and what things are important that they be taught. It simply blows my mind that a country that is as full of water as Thailand, I've seen pictures, unless I'm confusing it with Vietnam, of clusters of waterfalls, like 13 of them in an oval shape, all of them pouring god-awful amounts of water down, you know. It's just amazing how, and Thailand is a beautiful country. How could it be that of all those kids, they did not learn to swim? And you know, I grew up in an area that at the most could be called a settlement in Wisconsin, where there were no, we didn't have to worry about polio. We never had a swimming pool. I never saw a swimming pool, didn't know what one was. And how in the, and swimming is one of the things, even in the backwoods of Wisconsin, is something you can do for free that cools you off and is fun. And I cannot, simply cannot imagine, if they don't, if they have soccer teams, then they must not have, you know, child labor where these kids are all working all day at some factory or something that, for Apple or something. That, you know, they must.
No, these
have
kids go to school. They're in school. They're actually,
yeah,
you know.
That you know.
But you're surprised
it,
that they don't know.
It reminds me of the situation here too, where, when, you know, the proportion of Caucasians that make certain that their kids learn to swim is far greater than any of the other ethnicities that live in Chicago.
Well, Gina, I'm going to guess that that doesn't come down as much to ethnicities as it comes down to economics, that people
right,
with money
cost,
have the luxury.
Money, yeah, to
yeah,
get
to
access to
teach their
to water.
Kids how to swim.
Now, it blew my mind when I came, when I left Wisconsin, that anyone would ever pay to swim. Or ice skate, or any of those things,
sure,
because everything was free, and you know darn well that all you have to do is find a body of water, a lake. Now, I don't know if they have alligators or crocodiles or dangerous snakes. They probably have dangerous snakes, but it's just amazing to me that, you know, people don't find a way, and God knows there are recreational facilities that have been built in the, in, you know, many inner cities here in this country, so that kids can learn. It's just amazing to me, because it's a source, in a hot country like Thailand, it's a source of recreation.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Gene. Thank you very much for the call. I have another call, and we have a guest waiting again, so I had to cut you off there. And I don't know that all these kids can't swim. It's more the diving, I think, that's the bigger issue, because there's a pretty big deep-down dive in very dangerous, murky waters that these kids would have to complete to actually get themselves out. 312-981-7200. I think it is Cynthia on the line. Is this Cynthia?
Hello? This is Glenn.
Oh, Glenn. I don't know what they wrote. Oh, Glenn. All right. Something else weird was on the screen. Glenn, how are you this morning?
I am doing fine. I'm not sure if I can be a voice of reason at 3:45 in the morning.
Only if you disagree with Roger.
I do agree with Roger. You understand, if they're 2.5 miles down or in, the air pressure is different than what is on the surface, and you would have to have a hose big enough that would compensate for that, plus for what the boys are taking in to survive. I don't know if they thought about drilling a hole. My understanding is about a half mile below the surface and 2.5 miles in, I don't know how long it would take for him to drill a hole through the rock. But when, you know, push comes to shove, I think that should be better off with the buddy system, which I think it's probably what they're alluding to. I don't think they need to learn how to dive. I just think they need to learn how to, what's the word, work with the person that's trying to get them out. Well, I think they need a buddy system.
They are working on a buddy system. I think the diving is because there is one portion where the cave goes down quite a bit, like you're going down and then up a hill, and that's filled with water. And it's
I'm sure it's black. I'm sure it's a lot scarier than it is than walking through air. Yeah, but to take a hose 2 miles in, I think the air pressure is going to be different inside the cave than what's on the surface. It's going to get to the point where either you're going to have to wait them out, or if death is imminent, to get them out any means possible.
I appreciate the call. Thank you so much, Glenn. You know, Elon Musk's, if you didn't hear us earlier, his boring company, which is, you know, supposed to build our high-speed tunnel here in Chicago to O'Hare, representatives or people from his boring company are headed over there right now to see if there's a way they can drill and get to these guys. And they are looking for different ways. They're exploring every different option. And apparently my idea of let's just pump some air into it, which has been knocked down by Roger, is being confirmed by all of you out there.
Thank you very much.
Although
they're a half mile
one person
down.
No, they're not down. They're through. They're not really down from an entrance point. At least from the diagram I've seen, they're
according
two
to,
and a half miles in right. from where they can get in.
Well, now I'm looking at, again, another CNN. This is from last Wednesday. And the map I'm looking at is that they are 1.2 miles into the cave and half to 0.6 miles below the surface.
But it's like a mountainous surface. So
yes, that very mountainous
on, you
surface.
Know, how
right.
you go. But from right. the diagram I saw from the entrance, it's kind of straight through this kind of up and down tunnel system.
Mm-hmm.
But it's like, from what I saw, about 2.5 miles in from an entrance.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. It's going to be tough either way.
And they are preparing 4 months' worth of food to try to bring into the cave area just in case.
All right. I know you're all disagreeing with me, but we can get 4.5 months of food through this system, but we can't get a hose with air.
Cave to quote. This is from a cave rescue expert. Cave diving is incredibly dangerous for people who are very experienced doing it. And now you're looking at taking people who have no experience or very little experience with diving, putting them into a complete blackout situation where they have to rely on a regulator and the tanks with them to breathe. Misra, a member of the U.S. National Cave Rescue Commission, instead suggested the safest option would be to remain in place and continue to provide the boys with supplies until water levels drop or a new entrance is found.
I mean, I agree with it's too dangerous to try to get them to swim out.
Yeah.
If a seal has already died swimming back and forth,
right.
and the experienced divers, it's taking 5 hours, then I don't expect these kids who don't do this to be able to do that. But if you're going to tell me we're going to get 4.5 months worth of food in here, then tell me you can bring a hose with some oxygen. That's all I'm saying. We're moving on.
We're moving on.
You won. Everybody agreed with you.
I'm not saying I won. I'm just saying.
Wait until Lou gets in here, and I bet Lou will go, here's what we do.
Yeah.
Here's what we do.
Yeah.
And Lou will have an answer.
Of course he will.
Call Lou. Lou will figure this out.
He probably already has. Called him already.
You got to wait till 6 a.m., though.
Oh.
No, actually 7. We got a couple hours.
Okay.
Lou will be in with the answers.
He gets in a little early. I'll check with him.
Hey, our friend Mark Shipper, formerly of DNA Info Chicago, we chatted with him last year. He was out in San Fermín in Spain at the Running of the Bulls, and he is back there this year, and he's on a phone with us right now. Hey, Mark, good morning. How are you?
What's up, Matt? How are you?
I'm good, man. So you're back at the Running of the Bulls again.
Yeah, I'm back. This is the first full day of San Fermín's 2018.
So San Fermín's is a festival, and why do they have this festival every year?
That's a bit of a long story, but it has to do with a martyred Christian saint who was martyred during the late Roman times. He was from Pamplona. Originally, he was martyred in southern France. He was associated with some miracles during his lifetime. After he died, there was some strange activity at his grave. They started venerating him as a saint. He was sort of repatriated back to Pamplona, and he became the patron saint of Navarra. And that was the religious side of it. That was combined in the 15th century with a trade fair, which involved bullfighting as entertainment and music and a whole bunch of other stuff. And they combined those two things and created Feria de San Fermín, which is what we have today.
So the festival is San Fermín. That's not the location. The location is actually Pamplona, right? San Fermín is not a location at all, correct?
San Fermín is Saint Fermín, which is a Catholic saint, and Pamplona is the city, correct?
And so today is day one. Does that mean there'll be running of the bulls this morning, or did it already happen?
That already happened. That happened at 8 a.m. sharp.
Happens 8 a.m. local time. It's a little bit after 11 a.m. there now. And how many days?
Correct.
How many days in a row do they do the running?
That is 7 consecutive mornings.
7 mornings. And how was today? Did we get off without a hitch? Were there any problems?
Today was pretty smooth from what I saw. There was a thunderstorm about 30 minutes before the run. I opened up my window, which is kind of up on a high hill, and the rain was slamming down on these tile shingles out here. And I got pretty nervous about the run, but it actually went off pretty clean this morning. I don't even know if there was a goring. So the first run went well. I watched it from Plaza de Toros, which is the big arena at the very bottom of the run where they run the bulls into the corrals, where they'll wait until Corrida, which is the bull fight this afternoon. So I saw everybody run in.
And so do people stay in that stadium until the bullfight, or does it kind of clear out and people come back later in the day for the bullfights?
It clears out. The bullfight's not until 6:30 in the evening, so it clears out afterwards. After the bulls get into the corrals, there's 6 of them, they let Baca into the stadium, and that is a young bull who has its horns. There's like a cork stopper on the top of his horn so he can't gore anybody, and that bull just goes wild in the arena with all the people down there, and people chase it around and get flipped up in the air, and it's a big spectacle. Everybody laughs.
Jeez. Now, I imagine there is a lot of heat on Spain about the whole idea of bullfights anymore, and like with a bull running around like that. Are people protesting this, or do people who are upset about this just stay away from the festival altogether?
No, at the beginning of the festival, PETA always puts on a big protest, and then some independent protest groups come out and protest bullfighting. It's been a hot subject in Spain for, about the last 40 years. And it's not going away anytime soon. So one side feels like it's got the edge, then the other side feels like it's got the edge. It's always in just kind of a holding pattern. Bullfighting and bull running is on for now, but there are plenty of people who'd like to see it go away today.
I imagine. And at the end of the bullfight, a bull does die. Does just one bull die at the end of the bullfights every day?
6 bulls die during the bullfight. And there's an abattoir or butchery inside the arena, and once they're killed, they're taking them back and butchered up for their meat, just like cows are in the States, and all that meat is sold and eaten by the people. So none of the meat goes to waste. So it's the corrida or the bullfight is a ritual sacrifice of an animal, and that's kind of the best way to explain it without going into a lot of details.
So then when you're out at night during the festival, are there different restaurants that are featuring steaks made from the bulls that passed that day?
Yeah, there are. I'm not exactly sure how that works here. Generally, in the city where the bull is butchered, there are restaurants who get the prime pieces, like the tail and the tongue and all the expensive cuts of meat, just like steaks in the United States. But I'm not sure where they are here, or if that even happens, they may be shipped out somewhere else. That was always the tradition for hundreds of years, obviously, because transportation wasn't so easy. I'm not sure if that meat is eaten right here or shipped out somewhere else, but I think it's still eaten in the city where the bull was killed.
Mm-hmm. So during the festival, so it's a 7-day-long festival. We have the running of the bulls in the morning. We have bullfights in the afternoon. What else is part of the festival? What else is going on?
So the bullfight is kind of the secular, the bulls and the bullfight. This area does revolve around the bulls. They kind of set the rhythm for the day in the morning and the afternoon. And then in the evening, they're run up from their corral up to a secondary corral, which is where they're released from in the morning. So that even kind of ends the night with the bulls. But the rest of the feria is religious or historical in nature. So like this morning, for example, I was at the procession of San Fermin, which is they pull a likeness of the saint from his chapel in the church, and he's carried around the streets to much veneration and singing and adoration. And with him is another tradition called the Gigantes and Cabezudos, which is the giants and the big heads. And they're kind of these figures that date to the 1800s. The giants are huge, they're like 14 feet high. And the big heads are these big, ugly heads that kind of chase kids around and scare them. And they march through the streets and spin and dance, and the saint is venerated. And that's actually what I was watching before you called. They march all through the city with that. And the bells ring, and the saint is kind of brought out from his church one time a year. And the bells sort of summon him from wherever it is he's resting. And he comes out and sees his city again.
And so do they do that every single day, just like the running in the morning and the bullfight in the afternoon? Is the whole festival the same kind of rituals every day?
There are different traditions every day. The big heads and the giants come out most days. The saint is actually just carried around on this first day, and then he's brought up to the big cathedral on top of the hill where he stays and overlooks the feria for the 7 days. So the procession of the saint only happens today.
Now, I can't remember, Mark, when we talked last year, you were there last year working on a documentary. Is that why you're back this year? Are you guys still working on that documentary?
No, actually, I just got bit by the bug last year.
I know you're back.
Yeah, I didn't realize I was infected, and then the year started going on, and my brain started asking me, what are you doing in July? And it asked me enough times, and I finally answered. I guess I'm going back to San Fermine, so I'm back.
Very cool. All right, well, tell me, what's the status of the documentary?
The documentary, which is called Fiesta, is due to be out this fall. They wanted to debut it the day before this year's Fiesta, but there were just a few, like a lot of movies have, there were a few hang-ups they ran into. Sure. They wanted to get a better advertising campaign up, and wanted to make some fixes to it. So I'm contributing a couple written pieces to that. You'll be able to find it at a website, but that's not going to be out until this fall.
All right, so you're back for the festival. You know, the festival, of course, anybody who doesn't know, the Running of the Bulls, the Pamplona Festival, San Fermin, was made famous for us Americans by Ernest Hemingway in his book, The Sun Also Rises, and Americans have been probably heading over there ever since then for the Running of the Bulls. What is it like being an American there? Are Americans sort of like the people that you kind of hang your head and go, God, I don't want to be associated with these drunks that are out running the streets every day. These are the ones that are getting gored, making asses of themselves, or are we a relatively well-behaved group over there?
No, you're talking about the Australians, Matt.
Oh, really? It's the Australians that are doing that?
Yeah.
I didn't know.
I'm just kidding. The Australians have a little bit of a reputation around here for being kind of nuts. They jump off this 20-foot fountain and catch each other. And the Australians love a good time, man, and they are wild. As far as Americans go, there's a lot of them, and there's a lot of English, too. Hemingway's book went over very well in England. He had several English characters in his book. And so there's a lot of Anglo-Saxon representation over here. And for the most part, people are pretty good. There's always going to be embarrassing drunks at a festival like this, but the Americans don't stand out in any way. And actually, a lot of Americans have been coming here for a lot of years and kind of established themselves as part of the foreign fiesta. And they do pretty well. It's not embarrassing to be an American here.
Is it a really drunken festival, like kind of the reputation that we've kind of maybe have in our minds has it as, or is it more of a leisurely festival than maybe I'm thinking of it?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Everybody kind of has their own feria. It takes all kinds, as the saying goes. For some people, it's a 7 day, 8 night spree, or whatever you want to call it, and it's drunk all day and drunk all night, and they just look like, you can spot these people on the streets, they just look like, after about the second day, they just look like zombies out in the streets, their clothes are stained, they're filthy, they're just a mess. And then there's a whole lot of other people, especially the Spanish, the Basque and the Navarans, and the Spanish themselves. They're impeccably dressed in white and red. It's a major family fiesta. They're out here with their kids and grandkids and enjoying all elements of it. It's about food. It's about good drink. It's about enjoying the company of important people. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of that, too. I would say the dignified fiesta far outweighs the drunken debauchery.
Okay. Well, that's good. Is there a lot of Hemingway stuff you can do while you're there in town? Are there readings? Are there discussions? Is Hemingway embraced as part of this?
Yeah, he's a big part of it. And it's funny, depending on who you talk to, people either love that or hate that. Hemingway, there's a statue of Hemingway in front of Plaza de Toros. He's the only foreigner with a statue. There's a street named after him next to the Plaza de Toros. And then most of the shops will sell a Hemingway T-shirt and some Hemingway knickknacks and stuff like that. He's a big part of this fiesta, absolutely. A lot of people come here because of his book still today. And but like a lot of things, once their time has gone, the art will endure, but so will the schemes to make money off the art. So for a lot of people, Hemingway is just a way to make a few bucks on a T-shirt.
Sure. And I can't remember, Mark, did you run last year while you were there?
No, I didn't. I was working every morning during the bull run, so I was photographing or video or taking notes. So I didn't run. I walked out on the course this year a little late, and I was down from where you need to be, so they booted us all off the course. Whether or not I'm going to run, I haven't really decided. It was fun watching it in the arena this year and watching everybody run in, but I may get down there one of these days and run.
So you're not sure if you're going to. Does that mean you're a little nervous about the idea of it? What's holding you back from doing it?
Well, yeah, I mean, it's a frightening prospect. You know, I train jiu-jitsu 6 or 7 days a week, so I feel like I get a lot of this martial energy out of my system. I don't know that I need to prove myself running in front of 6 bulls who I can't predict what their behavior is going to be and who could easily kill me if something goes wrong.
Now,
that and the fact that this course is full of thousands of people who I have no control over either also, you know, right. Makes me a little uncomfortable.
Right, sure. Yeah, that's kind of the thing, is not only the bulls, but the other people on the course, many of whom may have drank more than they should have and things like that and aren't properly ready to do this. But if you really wanted to say you did it, but not really put yourself in danger, there's a way you could do that, right? Make sure you're all the way up at front, run real fast, and then climb over a wall. I mean, do you think there's people who get out there and don't really put themselves in much danger at all? Or do you think once you get in there, anything could happen and it's scary?
Well, there is no safe spot on that course once it's locked in and the bulls are on the course. I mean, there is no safe spot. And it's a lot like I played football growing up, and I like to make this analogy to people. The safest way to play football is at full speed. If you're standing still on the field and you're scared, you're going to get yourself hurt.
Right.
If you run hard and you play hard and you just go all in on it, you're much more likely to survive the game intact. So the bull running is the same thing. There's a lot of people who get on the course with either the intention of not running or they just freeze. It's a bit of an unpredictable reaction. It's very much a fight or flight situation.
Yeah.
And some people just absolutely freeze on the course and they create these walls of people along the edges of the course. And sometimes the bulls just plow into them and the people who thought they were going to be safe get hammered. But it's funny you said get up in front of the bulls and jump over a fence. In the arena today, they have a name for these people. They call them the Valientes. And that sounds a bit like the English word valiant, which means brave. And so it's a very sarcastic phrase, valientes. You get some of these people who run into the arena about 2 minutes in front of the bulls, and it takes 3 minutes to run the course, so they're in absolutely no danger, and they get whistled at and booed at, and sometimes they get some food thrown at them and stuff. So being one of the brave ones who runs in front of the bulls long before they get there also is that can lead to some shame.
That's hilarious. That makes sense. So if you're going to do it right. Put yourself in danger. Don't run half a mile ahead of them just so you can say you did it, and then you don't even see them until they're in the ring. That's funny.
Exactly.
It's just like being at a sporting event here at the U.S. where they boo the home team when things aren't going how we want it. That's too funny. Now, Mark, will you be there all week? Like, if we try to call you back next weekend, will you still be there, or will you already be on your way back?
I'm going to be here for the duration. I'll be there for the full feria. So if you want to get back in touch, we can definitely do it again.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's touch base next week, and we'll hear your tale of the day that you ran with the bulls.
All right, brother. Way to put me on the spot. Maybe that'll get me down there.
All right, Mark. Thanks so much for jumping on the phone. That's Mark Shipper, and he is at the Running of the Bulls. It's in San Fermin. No, it's in Pamplona. It's the San Fermin Festival. If you have never read... if you've never read The Sun Also Rises, I read it, I don't know, back in high school or college. That's where I first fell in love with it. It's on my bucket list. I don't know if I'll ever get a chance. I hope Mark does it. I want to hear about it. We got the news right now. We're a little bit late. Let's check the headlines, Mr. Badish. Tonight. Sundays on WGN-TV, it's the end of the homestand at Wrigley. Time to give the Cincy a few lovely parting gifts. Time to give the Cincy a few parting gifts.
Could you spell that, please?
The Cincy, a few parting gifts. Okay. Cubs Reds Sunday at 1 on WGN-TV Sports. Why do the Cubs keep losing to the Reds?
I don't know.
It's funny. They are just unstoppable forces, and then suddenly they're very human.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Like, they won like six in a row, and then all of a sudden...
The White
against
Sox.
The last place team. Oh, the Cubs I was talking about, but the White Sox...
The White Sox,
they're trying.
Just very human.
Yeah.
But that's where the Cubs were a couple years ago. And
that's
where
true.
They got.
That's true. They were building.
They are rebuilding.
Yeah.
They are rebuilding. Our friend Mark Shipper, who is on the phone, if you want to check out, he just sent Jess a video. We're going to try to put that up on our show fan page on Facebook. Go to Facebook and like the Matt Bubala Show. We're going to put up some video there. You can also check out his Instagram, which is Ships. Got Picks. Ships Got Picks is his Instagram.
It's easy for you to say.
And Ships is S-C-H-I-P-P-S, I believe. Ships. Oh, it is H. Oh, see, his name is Shipper, S-C-H-I-P-P-E-R. So I assumed, but Jess says no, it's just Ships, like as in a sail ship.
Yeah.
S-H-I-P.
Oh.
Ships Got Picks, S-H-I-P-S. Ships Got Picks. On Instagram, he's putting up a lot of photos, not just of the Running of the Bulls, but he sent me one earlier before we got on the air of a cathedral, and like, you know, he said a lot of religious imagery and things like that going on.
Nice.
He'll have lots of cool stuff. Go to Facebook and click on the Matt Bubala Show.
Of course.
And there we go. And we'll check back in with him next weekend here on the show.
You need to get out there.
I really do. I really want to.
But then again, if you run at that... The way I saw you waddle or run through the hallway with your cup of coffee earlier, you're in trouble.
Wow.
I can get away with it because
Where
I'm way older than you.
From?
Well, I don't know if you were shuffling or if you were trying not to spill your coffee or if you were.
I
don't
was
know
a
what
Diet
you were doing.
Coke and I didn't want it so shaken up
right?
that I couldn't open it up.
But running there to get it. You weren't, I don't know if you were, like, doing a fast walk.
What did you just say, Jesse?
What did she say?
She just said, what did you just say?
What?
Oh, my God.
What did she say?
She said, it's your bubble butt.
Oh, my God.
Wow. You two, did I not buy pizza this morning?
Yes, you did. And thank you so much. It was delicious with my espresso.
Pizza, I'll tell you that.
Yeah.
God. They turned on him at 4:46 in the morning.
I just think you're going to need a little training. Kind of get back in shape.
All right.
Yeah. You need to get back into your little league shape.
Don't try to make up for it. There's no coming back from that. After, can I just say what I just did for Jess just yesterday? Just yesterday, what I did for you?
What'd you do for Jess?
Now you feel bad, don't you? And you should.
Uh-oh.
Yes, you should.
Uh-oh.
Well, Jess was downsized a couple of weeks ago at the job she had. They
oh, right,
let go
right.
like five people. Jess was one of them.
Oh, my gosh.
So Jess texted me earlier this week. She said, hey, I'm applying for some jobs. At
oh, yeah, she told me about that this
said,
tonight.
Okay,
yeah.
Excellent. Have them call me. So I get a call.
Mm-hmm.
On Thursday or something. And the guy said, hey, so-and-so, Jess Rain's apply. Oh, Jess, I love Jess. And I said all these amazing things about her.
Yeah.
And I didn't say to the guy, well, sometimes she calls me fat.
And bubble butt.
Yeah. Didn't mention that part.
And she got the job.
I should have said, well, I hope the boss there has a thick skin. Because here's the thing. If he's fat, Jess will just say it to his face. So be prepared for that part of her. She's great otherwise, but if you don't look good, she might say, looking kind of ugly today, aren't you?
Mm-hmm.
She might just do that to you. You didn't call, she didn't call me fat until after she got the job and after I had already told people what a great person she was. Then she's like, well, got the job. Hey, Matt, you're fat. I don't know if you were aware, so I'm just going to mention this now. What Roger's saying is, you're fat. It did bring up something I wanted to ask about, though.
I'm sorry.
Jess keeps trying to kiss my butt now in my ear, and it's not working at all, because my fat butt doesn't want to hear it. So I get this call about Jess, and of course, Jess had put me down as a reference.
Right.
So they call, and then I say all these immaculately wonderful things about her.
Mm-hmm.
And afterwards, I'm thinking, does that really do any good? Do you ever call? Do they ever call somebody? And you know, the guy calls me and goes, hey, Jess Raines, blah, blah, blah. And I say, hey, listen, I know that she put me down as a reference because I couldn't tell her not to because that would sound bad. But here's the thing. Do not hire this person. Do you think they ever hear anything but just, oh, my God, they're so great. And, yeah, they're smart.
I don't think they would ever. Because
don't
you don't put down a reference that you know is going to give you a bad rap.
Yeah, you feel pretty good about the idea that they're going to say nice things about you.
Right.
And I wonder if they're ever, you know, maybe the people that it's there for, the people that are so unaware of themselves that they put people down and then they get the call and they're like, what, who? Oh, God, that guy? No, that's why he's not here anymore. You don't want him either. I mean, that must happen sometimes, right? Or else they wouldn't. Or is this just for them to check off a box saying, well, we called three references. They all said they were great. We had no idea they'd kill 40 people.
What?
Joe said they'd be fine. What else are we supposed to do?
I can't
say the point of it?
For sure that you might get a bad reference from someone you've put down as a reference. I can't say for sure that would never happen. But I don't know how you would put down a reference that you know in your heart is not going to give you a good reference.
Well, that's good. Do you know in your heart? Because, like, say, you know, it was somebody who was your superior and you know, maybe things weren't that great, but you think, well, they weren't that bad. And so you say to the superior, because that's who they're going to want to call, like, hey, I'm going to put you down as a reference. You're my lesser, blah, blah, blah. Does anybody ever say to that person, that's not a good idea. Don't put me down.
I'm sure that's happened before.
I will not give you a good reference.
Yeah, I'm sure that's happened before, but probably in the context of maybe the worker wasn't really that connected to start with that person, and they're only putting that person or want to use that person as reference because of their position.
And I suppose, hopefully, that's what they're going to say is like, hey, you know what? I didn't work that closely with you. I don't feel qualified to really answer questions. I don't know how you were day to day and things like that. You know, it's really Bob over in accounting that you should be talking to.
Yeah.
Don't use me.
Yeah. But then, you know,
and
there's got to be a reason why Bob wasn't put down as a reference.
You just don't want to say anything good about me, do you? Like, dude, this is why you don't work here.
You
just
had it in for me then, and you got it in for me now.
Boy, now you won't even give me a good reference. Boy, some help you are. Thanks a lot. Jeez. And then I'm going to give you a bad Yelp review is what I'm going to do.
I've been very lucky in my career. I would say in about 95% of the companies I've worked for, I've gotten an excellent reference from the actual head of the company that I worked for.
That's good.
Whatever the top person was, and it was very, very nice, you know.
So they didn't say, well, other than the time I had to run down the hall and Roger said I looked like I waddled, that never came up, huh?
That's why I'm not using you as a reference.
312-981-7200. Orion is along in 8 minutes. They'll be much more nicer to him, I promise. News will be coming up right after that. Lots to do. 720 WG. Well, the party is about to wrap up. Matt Bubal here with you. It's 4:56 in the morning. 412 just texted, why are they attacking you, Matt? No more pizza for the staff. Good point, 412. Thank you.
That's all right. I can buy some.